it's
sorry. Paused right now.
There we go.
Now it's. There we go. See the problem?
All right.
That's giving us an opportunity to identify ourselves as someone else. And
you could say you're someone else. I.
Why don't we get started, folks? I'll call.
But
you have the nameplate. I'll call to order the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. And I think what we'll do is introduce ourselves. We do not have a quorum, so we will begin hearing these matters and laying them over until we do have a quorum for decision. My name is Steve Smith. I'm a state representative. And let's start at that end and just identify yourself.
My name is Doug Wardlow, State Representative from Eagan, District 38B.
Steve Simon, State Representative from District 44A, which is Hopkins and St. Louis Park. And sometimes I get Representative Smith's mail. He might.
I was introduced once at a speech before a group as Senator Simon. And I told the audience.
Insulted you twice.
I told the audience if you like what I say, I'm really State Representative Steve Smith. But if you don't like what I say, I am Simon. Senator.
Morty, I'm Chuck Wigger, State Senator Maplewood. When district is 55, and also includes North St. Paul and Oakdale, and I'm new to the committee.
Very good. All right. In order as listed. Claim against Minnesota Department of Revenue, the matter of Renee Johnson. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, could I summarize this briefly?
And then, please.
And then we'll have the testifiers testify. Renee Johnson is from Brooklyn Park. She is requesting the reissuance of her 2003 property tax refund check for $1,118. The check was issued in September of 2004. She was or is 47 years old, Parkinson's disease controlled. She slipped on ice back in 2005. Had knee damage and surgery. The check, according to the law, is valid for 2 years from issue. So it would have expired or become invalid in September of 2006. If there's good cause, the Commissioner of Revenue can have it be 5 years instead, in which case it would be September of 2009. She called the Department of Revenue, apparently, in September of 2010, and so she missed those deadlines. The check was lost, she argues, because of the chaos from her knee injury, and she found it recently and would like to have it honored. That's pretty much the story in this case.
Mr. Lendecky, do we have a definition of good cause either in statute or custom and usage?
We have actually two of these, and I don't know of a definition of good cause. Maybe the person from the Department of Revenue would know if there's a specific definition of good cause for this purpose. But we have issued and we have honored a refund of an overdue a claim for a property tax refund once before. It was 2 years ago, a bill 2 years ago. And in that one, the woman put her, or had a friend, her neighbor, because she wasn't able to go out to the mailbox, a rural mailbox. She had her refund claim put in the mailbox. She showed evidence that there had been a number of thefts from mailboxes in her area. The police verified that. She believes her request for the refund was stolen. After hearing the discussion of the illness that caused her not to be able to remember that she hadn't gotten her check and all of the reasons why she wanted an excuse and wanted the money back, the subcommittee in 2009, even though the law didn't permit it, the subcommittee granted her request, paid the claim, and she got her property tax refund back, even though she had missed the deadlines. So we have had that happen before.
Have there been claims for property tax refund past the time
that have been denied by this subcommittee?
I have not seen one denied yet. The only one for property tax refund that I'm aware of is the one 2 years ago. Her name was Eggy, and we paid that 2 years ago.
Gentlemen at the table, identify yourself, who you're with, and go ahead.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. And I don't know what you want me to add. I mean, we do have a published a revenue notice that describes what reasonable cause is specifically in these circumstances for reissuing cash checks.
You have a written definition?
We have a written definition. Giving some examples. I mean, illness would be one of them. The question would be, you know, if we were, well, to start, we don't have authority to, it wasn't relevant in this case as far as we were concerned because we didn't have the authority because the claim came in, or the request for the new check came in after the five-year period. So we didn't really look at it. But the question would be whether, you know, how long does an illness forgive somebody from acting? And that would be the real question. And we'd be looking at things like what, you know, sure, there was something that happened when the check was originally granted, but what happened in the intervening 2, 3, 4, 5 years that we'd be looking at? Like how many other refund checks were issued to her that she cashed? How did her life go in general during the rest of the time? We'd be looking at those kind of things if we were actually going to look at issuing it for reasonable cause.
Renee Johnson, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear us? Can you hear us?
Pretty much.
This is a subcommittee on the House Senate subcommittee on claims. We're taking up your matter now. A request for reissuance of a 2003 property tax refund. Would you summarize your side, please?
Excuse me. Well, first of all, thank you for your time and hearing what I have to say. I appreciate it. And you'll have to excuse me, I just took some medication, so my speech might be kind of halted. So bear with me as I try to explain. As I outlined in my letter, I was diagnosed with TD in 2001, and I broke my knee shortly after I received my refund check. And to kind of make it very succinct, I've had 4 surgeries as a result of this break. It has significantly affected my PD symptoms, and sorry, I'm a little bit nervous as well, just making it all that much harder to talk.
You're doing fine. You're doing fine. Just keep going.
Anyway, so I was laid up for quite a while with the surgeries and physical therapy and doctor visits and whatnot, and I don't know how I lost track of that check, but I've never had a broken bone before or experienced any kind of significant medical issue like this. So I suppose that kind of played into check, and I have no idea why it ended up where it did, but with all the commotion going on, I apparently lost track of it, and just fairly recently, I was digging through some checks, or canceled checks, and anyway, I came across it, much to my surprise. I mean, it's a lot of money to misplace. But I was hoping that it might be reissued under the circumstances with being on disability and the cost of medications and whatnot. And boy, I sure could have used that money at the time that I had it, but I didn't even realize I had the check. So with all the people in and out and all the traveling about that I had to do for doctor's visits and hospitalization, all I can say is it got misplaced. and I don't know how or why, but that's essentially what it comes down to.
Ms. Johnson, thank you. Does any member of the committee have any questions of the testifier? If so, raise your hand or identify yourself and then go ahead. Any questions? Mr. Lindecki?
Mr. Chair, Renee, I'd like to ask if after that particular check, the 2003 check, you have filed for property tax refunds and for every year after that and gotten your checks and cashed them.
I'm sorry, your question?
The question was whether after the 2003 check, which you misplaced, you have filed for and received your property tax refunds in other years and cashed all of those checks.
Yeah, I believe I have. I'm assuming I have, just going by memory. I don't have that in front of me.
Okay, so this is the only one that you misplaced, couldn't find, and which you wound up finding later?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I received the other checks and cashed them. This was the only one that I found that I'm aware of that I haven't cashed.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? At this point, if it's appropriate, I think we'll lay the claim over and proceed with the next one. Ms. Johnson, thank you for being on the phone. The committee will notify you after this hearing as to the outcome. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Have a good day.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One more comment on this. When we did the one a couple years ago, we appropriate money from the general fund to the Department of Revenue, so it doesn't come out of their normal their expenses. It's a special appropriation in the claims bill to the department to pay the refund. That's how it works when we do these.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I had a question for the department. When a person does not present payment of a state-issued check, does that ever get published then as unclaimed property? Or is there a statutory obligation to provide notice?
Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weger. I know we had a problem with it because we were required to send over I think the answer is for income tax warrants, yes. For the property tax refund, the problem is that by time we would end up sending them to unclaimed property, I think they were already stale. So because of the general two-year period, so because they're only good for 2 years unless there's this reasonable cause. And I know for certain one year we published all of them sent them to some unclaimed property, and then it was a pretty bad situation. And that might have been the year that we actually changed the law to allow the refunds to be paid in for reasonable cause. I don't know the answer to the question, though. If you want, I could find it for the committee if you think that's...
Supply the answer.
Okay.
The earliest opportunity. Okay. Any other questions from the committee?
Sure.
Representative Wardle.
Yes, what was the law prior to the change to allowing payment upon reasonable cause?
Sure, Representative Wardlow. Up until about 1994, the law said that if we couldn't find the person who had the refund, it lapsed after 2 years. So that was a lot of renters move, we mail it out, it comes back. A lot of folks die, it comes back, it's sitting in our office. And that was the law up until 1994. And then in 1994, the law was changed to say that if the warrant was uncashed for 2 years, then it lapsed as well. So that would set up the situation that we have in this case. Prior to 1994, that wouldn't have happened. The warrant or the right to the check, I mean, the warrant might have been too old, but a new one would have been reissued. And starting in... And then in 2001 is when the law got changed to allow this five-year reasonable cause. And I remember I was involved in some of the discussions over it and didn't really think that reasonable cause was a very good standard for reissuing it, simply because of the difficulty, you know, why wouldn't somebody cash a check? I mean, is this reasonable cause in this circumstance? I don't know. But, I mean, if we wanted to keep it going for a longer period, we should have either gone back to the old law or just said if it's 5 years, you do it within 5 years, it's still good. If you're outside that, you aren't. But that's the history of this statute.
Any other questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why an expiration period at all?
Mr. Pedersen.
Representative Simon, I'm not sure. I think, going back forever, the idea was that it was a property tax relief, and the legislature clearly wanted folks to immediately turn around and use it for property tax. It started out as a homeowner refund program with the checks going out just in time for the second half payment. I guess the idea maybe was that if it goes on too long, you didn't really need the property tax relief. I'm not sure. The idea of it coming back to us, if we couldn't find the claimant, I suspect that back in the 70s and 80s, it was because there probably were a lot of people who died. Hundreds probably. And because they get filed in January or February, and the refunds don't get paid until August. So my guess is that there were a lot of refunds that we just had sitting there. I don't know how the state accounts for those kind of checks, but I'm sure that there was some thought of what's clearing these out. So that was probably why the law was originally put in. If we couldn't find the claimant in 2 years, we ain't ever going to find them.
Any other questions? All right, thank you. The chair's going to lay the bill over for action later in the agenda. Next claim, Mr. Lindecki.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is a claim by Jane Cron. Is Jane Cron here?
No.
No? Okay.
I informed her of the meeting, but she did not receive a response.
All right. Ms. Cron's claim was actually scheduled for the November meeting, and then it became clear that she hadn't been notified of the meeting, so we put the claim off until the first meeting of this new subcommittee. Her claim is for a 2008 property tax refund, and her excuses, if you've read them in there, have to do with moving, having her house on the market, alcoholism, Liberty Tax people in Fargo didn't finish doing her tax returns for her when she was undergoing treatment for alcoholism. A friend filed her 08 taxes, and the friend, it turns out, committed tax fraud, or so she claims. There are as many reasons and explanations for this as there are pages in this claim. And she refiled in October of 09. This one, however, was actually ruled on by Small Claims Tax Court in January of 2010, Judge Cheryl Ramstad.
Now, and that's on a separate check issue? Or is that on the same claim?
I believe it's on this very same refund request. And there was a summary judgment motion, and it was confirmed by Judge Cheryl Ramstad. My only question, if Ms. Cron were here, is did you actually appear at any of these things? And I don't know if the department can tell us that, but there doesn't seem, I mean, there is a lengthy discussion and brief by the Department of Revenue on the issue at the Small Claims Tax Court, but not a word from Ms. Cron that I can find, and there's no, I'm not even sure she appeared.
So, Mr. Pedersen, this claim has been taken to Small Claims Court and ruled upon and denied by a judge. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Do you have anything to add to the summary we just heard?
No.
All right. No. Any questions from the committee? I'm going to lay this one over as well, and we'll move along to the next claim.
And the next claim is against the Department of Human Services. By Hollis Larson, who is apparently up at the Moose Lake facility. Is that right? Is he still there?
Yes, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Right. And he has two claims here, actually, I believe.
Summarize the claim, or claims.
All right. The first claim is for his eyeglasses. He has had apparently a very nice pair of eyeglasses with transition lenses. And he claims when he went to segregation, the glasses were taken. When he got them back 2 days later, the right nose piece was missing. Nobody knows in the explanation from the guards involved. All they say is nobody knows if the nose piece was missing when they took the glasses, although one would have thought they would have noted that and considered them defective or broken or contraband or something. And so I'm just wondering why nobody seems to know whether the nose piece was missing in these discussions here. But in any event, he's been issued new glasses. I suppose they're not quite as nice as the ones he had, but he has been issued state-issued glasses.
And the alleged value of the property loss is $410. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The other $5,000 is violation of his constitutional rights or something like that.
So violating constitutional rights
is worth $5,000, Mr. Chair.
According to this claimant?
Yes.
Testimony?
I'm Anita Monin with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The one question that the security counselors did not document that the nose piece was broken off. The only thing that I can think of when I investigated this was that it wasn't broken, or else they would have documented that. What happens is they pack up all the property into bins when they go into the high security area, and they do note when things are broken. They do an incident report. I found no evidence of that type of documentation until when Mr. Larson came back to his regular living unit. They gave him his property. Then he returned to the security counselors and said, "Look, my nose piece is broken." So,
and
what
was the nose piece missing when they gave him the glasses back that they're aware of?
I believe there was an incident report that stated that they didn't notice it. The claimant brought it back up to the security counselors and said it's broken. Okay. So we have nothing telling us what happened to the glasses between the security counselor and the client coming back up.
So, and your name again?
Anita Moonan.
Ms. Moonan, so your suggestion to the committee is that there's no convincing evidence of any negligence on the part of the state.
Correct.
In this claim. Any questions from the committee? Is the claimant on the phone or not?
No.
Any questions? If not...
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Senator.
Being new, I'm just wondering if there could be a process for having a videotape showing any property once it's checked in, so it's clear as to what the condition is. There's cameras everywhere in these facilities. Why can't we have a camera showing the property so there's just a clear, rebuttable presumption that it's in good condition as opposed to a written report?
Dovetailing on that, what is the procedure for inventorying property on people that come in?
What happens is, the camera issue, property gets packed up quite often.
Yes.
So I'm thinking that they probably never thought to videotape a pack-up of property such as that. There is two staff involved in pack-ups. So then they inventory on a notice of secured receipt and pack it up in a bin with two staff there. They bring it down to the property area and store it until the client is out of high security area. Then they issue it back to the client.
Any other questions? Hearing no questions, we'll lay the matter over and move on to the next item.
Mr. Chair, the next one is also Hollis Larson. In this particular claim, it's kind of an odd situation.
What's the amount of the claim?
The amount of the claim is, again, $140 of lost property and $5,000 for violation of his constitutional rights or civil rights or something.
What's the property?
The property in this case is an AC adapter, some coaxial cable splices, an RCA Y cable patch cord, and the shipping and handling involved in buying these various things. And I don't know, it doesn't add up to, his own labor and the postage and copying costs.
It would appear from the items I'm looking at that the actual property was $35.91.
That's right.
All right. Testimony?
And Mr. Chair, the interesting thing about this is that apparently he was allowed to order this stuff and have it sent in to him at the facility. And the facility would say, but that's always subject to our inspection of the material when it arrives. When it arrived, the cord on the AC adapter was 6.5 feet, and only 6 feet is allowed at the facility. So they, rather than giving them the two or three items that were okay, they, apparently the policy is you keep the entire shipment from him, and they destroyed it just over a month later, apparently after giving him time to have it sent out or sent back to the company he bought it from. They followed their policy. It's just kind of an interesting policy that he can't have the things that were okay. They have to destroy all of the things.
Testimony, Ms. Warren.
That particular part of the policy has been changed this year. For the reason you stated, there's contraband in packages. Then the contraband gets the notice of contraband notice and gets sent out. And this particular claim, at the time, that was the policy that we confiscated the whole package, and it was either returned to the company or they could send it out. The contraband notice that he received gave him a deadline in order to send it out, and he did not respond to that deadline after several prompts from the staff saying, you need to give us a disposition on this property, and that he did try to argue that it was not property because of policies that we've got that says if both ends are connected, it can be longer than 6 feet, but these were not connected at both sides, so then the cable could be loose, and then it's longer than the allowed length. With that dialogue, all the way through the dialogue back and forth, he was told that he needs to give us a disposition. He failed to do that. The deadline passed, and then several weeks later, we destroyed that property. Of course, we destroy it because if we didn't, then we have property stacked up to the ceiling, and that would be our policy.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moonen, is it?
Yes.
Ms. Moonen, I guess the obvious question here is what expectation does pre-approval create in the resident here? His argument seems to be, well, this was pre-approved, so unless somebody slipped something into the package, which was obviously contraband, mm-hmm. if something's pre-approved, that implies that he's allowed to keep it once it's arrived, obviously if there's something else in there. That seems to be his argument, that hey, it's pre-approved, and now they're doing a bait and switch on me. What I know the policy has changed, but does in your mind, does pre-approval imply that once it comes, you can keep it or not, or is he wrong about that?
The pre-approval that he received, it specifically noted that you can order this, but once it gets here, we have to look at it and to make sure it's okay. And he was told that also several times. And that is for people to allow them to order things that is technically might be just fine to come into the facility. We'd look at it, we'd say, yep, it's good, and I can have it. And then we wouldn't have to list every item and so forth that could come in.
Any other questions? All right, Chair lays this one over. Next.
I'm just going to take a moment to get the a few people on the phone.
Is this the Russo matter?
This is the Russo matter.
Oh, we're not doing Rostrum. Rostrum is next up.
Oh, is there another one?
The pothole.
Oh, but that's, yeah.
Pothole issue.
First, there's Russo, who's also at the Department of Human Services.
Oh, okay. That is the second one.
$100 million.
Yes.
She's going to, like I said, she's going to tell us.
Hi, this is Anne.
Yes.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, Anne. This is Jackie. We are ready for to connect with you. So, do you have the phone number of the conference room that you're going to be in?
Yeah. And you're on speaker, by the way, too.
Okay. Let me open up the email I sent you yesterday with the information. All right, so you want to dial 651-431-3531. Mm-hmm. All right, sounds good. Thank you very much.
We will.
We'll move into that conference room now.
Okay, thank you. So let's call Mr. Russo on the phone.
Okay.
We'll call her.
Certainly better to have people actually come and testify. It's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Don't need to ask them to connect us.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Bartlett Winore, this is Michelle.
This is Jackie Dukeshire. I'm calling from the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. And I'm calling because we are supposed to be taking testimony from Mr. Stephen Russo, and I was given this phone number to call preliminarily.
Sure.
He's supposed to be in a...
Hold on. Let me give you a transfer to the number in there.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you very much.
I didn't make copies. For Mr. Russo.
He's coming.
We're connecting with him right now.
Hopefully. Well, he's made the claim, so he should know what's in it. We're not going to sit here all morning waiting for him to decide to answer the phone,
sure.
So I'd ask you to go ahead and start summarizing.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a claim that we have seen at the claims subcommittee before, and either we put it off, I think we denied it the last time we saw it, and we suggested to Mr. Russo that he follow legal procedures in order to try to get himself out of the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center, that we weren't the proper forum. In other words, we used our rule number one, which says if it can be in another forum, it should be. And since then, he's actually apparently been involved in some legal procedures, including the review committee that occurred on the in January of 2011, which found that he should stay civilly committed as a mentally ill and dangerous person. His request to get out was denied in here in Ramsey County. Special review board. So nothing much has changed. He except now he's followed one legal proceeding, and it did not get him out. The claim is, as Senator Wieger pointed out, for $100 million.
And he was committed in March of 1993 subsequent to an incident where he was convicted as not guilty by reason of insanity for the shooting and killing of an individual while in a delusional state. At least that's what I'm reading here. Is that correct?
That's correct. He says, however, that he's fine.
The state has suggested otherwise since March of 1993. Correct?
That's correct, and some would say that asking this legislature for $100 million this year is a sign of some kind of delusion.
Ann?
While we're waiting for the claimant on the
Diane,
phone,
any
questions
claims,
to
so
Mr. Leavitt?
We've got Ann Speaker, but we're trying to also connect with Mr. Russo, so could you hold on for a second, please, okay? Michelle, this is Diane with the Subcommittee on Claims. We were trying to connect with Mr. Russo.
Yeah,
we got cut off before.
I got cut off. Mm-hmm. I'll transfer you in there again. Hold
okay.
On.
We need to talk to him right now. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks.
Nice music.
Yes, very soothing.
Yes.
I wonder if they pipe that into all the rooms.
I have to tell Mr. Russo that his lawyer's not here.
Are you soothed?
Pleasantly,
Mr. Russo?
Pleasantly soothed.
Mr. Hello? Hello? This is Mr.
Hello?
Mr. Russo?
Hi, Mr. Russo. This is this is Jackie.
Hi, Jackie.
We've got you on speakerphone now, and we are going to be talking about your claim with the subcommittee, okay?
And I just want I also wanted to check. Ann, are you on the line? Ann?
Oh,
Ann?
Yes.
Ann?
Hi.
Okay. So all the parties are here now.
All right.
Mr. Russo, just to let you know in advance, your lawyer came and saw me this morning and just told me that he had a conflict come up, and so he wasn't able to attend the actual meeting.
Okay.
Mr. Russo, my name is Representative Smith. I'm chairing the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Summarize your claim, the basis of your claim for $100 million. Go ahead.
I, Stephen Russo, do not suffer from mental illness in St. Peter Regional Treatment Center is wrongfully confining me.
Does that conclude your summary, Mr. Russo?
Yes.
Any questions from the committee of Mr. Russo?
No. Okay. Not at this time.
All right. Anyone else have questions in this room? I don't hear any. Mr. Russo, we're going to lay this matter over, make a decision today, and you'll be notified of the results from this committee.
Did you want to hear from the department at all?
Department, are you there?
We're here, Representative Smith.
Okay, I apologize. I didn't know you were on the line. Go ahead if you have any further testimony on this case.
My name is Anna Casola, and I'm appearing on behalf of the department. In attendance is Mr. Bill Gallagher as well. And our response pretty much summarizes The letter I sent him summarizes our response to Mr. Russo's claim, which is that there's no basis to consider this claim. The Department of Human Services does not have, according to statute, the SRB, who cannot be comprised of people associated with DHS, make a determination as to whether Mr. Russo should continue to be confined. And so DHS, Mr. Russo's claim wrongly lies against DHS. And to the extent that they found that he should not be discharged, he has no claim for $100 million for wrongful confinement.
What was your last name again, please?
Russo.
Ecosola.
From the Department of Human Services, a question for you, ma'am.
Ecosola.
Ms. Ecosola. Has this matter been considered by the Department of Human Services Special Review Board?
That's who I was referring to as the SRB. It has been considered, and they concluded that Mr. Russo is not eligible for discharge.
The remind us of the procedure that the Special Review Board follows in hearing and determining these matters. In other words, what kind of rules are you bound by? Is there a hearing? Is there notice to Mr. Russo, an opportunity to be heard? Can he submit any written documents? Just give me a brief summary of the procedure that you follow.
This is Bill Gallagher. I'm the Special Review Board Coordinator for the Department of Human Services. Yes, Mr. Russo does know this procedure, too. He's been in front of the Review Board several times. He submitted a petition, I believe it was last October in 2010. The Special Review Board then did receive a hearing, or did hold a hearing on January 5th, 2011, at which time he was represented by his counsel, Brian Southwell, and yet they do have the opportunity to provide written documentation at that time, and it was my assessment at the time that Mr. Southwell did adequately represent Mr. Russo in providing the information and an argument to the Special Review Board.
So there was oral argument on the part of Mr. Russo by his attorney, is that correct?
Yes, there was at the time in front of the Special Review Board. The Review Board then has a period of time, essentially 30 days under the statute, Minnesota Statute 253B.18, is the Commitment and Treatment Act that the Review Board follows. They have to consider a number of things. Essentially, there are three criteria they have to consider. Then by statute, is the person no longer mentally ill? Is he capable of, and no longer dangerous to the public? Is he capable of making an adequate adjustment to open society? And is he no longer in need of the current supervision and treatment? Those are the three criteria under the statute. I believe it's under 253B.18, subdivision 15. And then they make recommendations to the Commissioner of Human Services. So the Commissioner of Human Services, within 14 days of their written criteria, writes an order, and that order subsequently denied Mr. Russo discharge. He then has an additional 30 days to file a petition under the statute 253B.19 with the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court appeal panel, then to hear his appeal of that commissioner's order. And then that's a de novo hearing in front of the Supreme Court appeal panel.
Did the claimant in this matter appeal this decision from the...
Not to my knowledge, he did not.
Any other questions from the committee of Mr. Gallagher or the claimant?
I just wanted to add that I have a comment to add once the representative or the panel has had an opportunity to ask the question.
Do you have a comment? Say it now. I don't see any questions.
I do. Okay. I also want to raise a procedural issue. Mr. Rousseau has brought DHS before the LCC twice. This is our second time here. When, according to statute, he really has no grounds to do that. According to the Subcommittee on Claims rules and procedure, the subcommittee shall not consider any claim over which another tribunal or court has jurisdiction. Now, he has two opportunities. He's already taken this matter to the court, and the court dismissed it. The tribunal that we can refer to here would be the SRB, and they have a process which he's not only availed himself of, but he has not completely gone through that process, which is the appeals process that Mr. Gallagher was referring to. But my point is that we believe the LCC should not hear this claim, so that even in the future, Mr. Rousseau does not bring DHS before the Subcommittee on Claims again on this matter.
All right, thank you. Any other questions from anyone? Everyone on
yes.
Mr. Rousseau, go ahead.
I'd like to make a statement if I could.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a 10/14/10 letter to the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims stating that I had a phone call with Pete, the former coordinator of the legislature. He told me specifically that all I had to do to satisfy coming before the committee was to go to the special review board first before coming to the subcommittee. And I have a letter, again, dated October 14, 2010, to the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims regarding that matter. Also, my lawsuit against Dr. Jennifer Service was dismissed by the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit August 21st, 2008. So that was no longer a lawsuit available to me.
Mr. Chair?
Our response to that, representative, is that the rules do not allow Mr. Rousseau to forum shop. What he's trying to do then is that once he gets a no from those forums that should really hear the case, he's looking for the LCC to relitigate the matter and come to a different conclusion, which he cannot do. What the LCC does is hears claims that the claimant does not have an opportunity to present in a different forum.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindecki, go ahead.
I'd just like to say that we don't know exactly. We're going to apparently act on these claims a little bit later on, but we do have a Rule 13 that Mr. Rousseau ought to know about. Rule 13 says that a claim that has been previously heard and denied by the subcommittee shall not be reconsidered unless the claimant presents newly discovered evidence that by due diligence could not have been discovered in time for the earlier hearing. So the fact is that if his claim is denied, that we will not allow it to come back before this subcommittee again.
To everyone on the phone, thank you for your testimony. Now I'm going to ask a question for people on this end, not you folks on the phone. Anyone have any questions on this end? I see no questions. Thank you. Well, I'm going to lay the matter over. You'll be notified of our decision after today.
Thank you.
Mr. Lindecki, next.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is by Lori Brostom. Brostrom. Is Lori Brostrom here?
Nope, the next claim is against Guy Israel Green.
Against Guy Israel Green. Hmm. What happened to, in my book, administration, I'm sorry. All right.
This appears to be a claim for $46,000. Are we getting this gentleman on the phone or not?
I do not believe so.
Is anyone here on his behalf? Mr. Lindecki, summarize the claim, please.
Mr. Chair, this person, Guy Israel Green, was convicted. It was a very interesting situation where the Department of Corrections individual driving Mr. Guy Israel Green back to the facility or something stopped because he had to make a rest stop at a convenience store and said, we don't know exactly what he said. He said something like, well, you can walk away or you can wait here. Someone else thinks maybe he said, you must stay here. It's unclear exactly what he said to Mr. Green, but Mr. Green did walk away and was ultimately convicted in at the district court level of felony escape along with assault, apparently, on the official. Which must have occurred earlier. But at the appellate court, approximately a year later, because these things always take so long when you appeal. It takes a very long time to get a hearing and then a decision from the Court of Appeals. And one would argue that they need more money or more judges or something. But in any event, a year later, the appeals court said that it was not clear that he should have been convicted of the felony escape. So he spent more time in prison than he would have had it because he should not have been convicted of the felony escape. Well, he apparently heard about a claim that we paid last year in last year's claims bill, William Hines. And the situations are different, but Mr. Green sees that we paid Mr. Hines $50 a day for nearly a year of excess in imprisonment that shouldn't have happened. And he feels that he was incarcerated for too long a time and that he should get $46,000. I believe he figures the same $50 a day. The situations, from at least my point of view, are different. Mr. Hines was the victim of a mistake made by the lower court judge in sentencing Mr. Hines. The lower court judge improperly gave him a higher than zero, criminal history score. Thank you very much. Ms. Rehack is here from the court system. In the appellate court brief, it was the prosecutor who pointed out, as a little asterisk at the end of her brief, that, oh, by the way, I think that it should have been a criminal history score of zero. I think that he should not be spending this much time in prison. And again, it took over a year for that appellate court to actually make a ruling. And Mr. Hines spent a year in prison that he shouldn't have because there was, and the judge agreed, the prosecutor agreed, the defense attorney agreed, they all agreed, and the appellate court agreed that a mistake had been made by the lower court judge in coming up with a criminal history score. So that's a different situation. There was a clear mistake. This situation with Mr. Green hinges entirely on an interpretation by the lower court judge that's different from the interpretation of the appeals court as to what exactly was said to whom at that convenience store and whether Mr. Green actually had the right to walk away or not or whether he was under arrest. So there was just, and this is what appeals courts do all the time from my point of view, and I know we talked a lot about this at the Hines claim with Ms. Rehack and others, that the appeals court makes decisions all the time that overturn lower court decisions. And each one of these has some either financial or time spent effect on people, and that's just what they do. This one, the Guy Israel Green case, is simply not the same as the Hines case.
So, Lindeck, you've explained the differences between the case where this committee recommended paying the claim that it is different. One last question of you. If the rate then was $50 a day and he spent 460 days, that doesn't come up to $46,000. It comes up to one half of that, around $23,000. Why the difference, if you know?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. But I do know that the $50 comes from the state of Iowa. We thought about it very carefully. Had a lot of different states we could have followed in coming up with the Hines claim. We actually also, Ms. Rehack was very helpful and very forthcoming in trying to come up with exactly how many days extra Mr. Hines had spent in prison.
Anyone on the committee have any questions? Seeing none, we'll lay the matter over and get on to the next one.
All right, Mr. Chair, what is the next one?
Bostrom Laurie.
All right.
Any testifiers on this case?
Yes,
she's apparently going to...
Ms. Bostrom will be on the phone with us shortly.
Anyone in the room wanting to be heard on this matter?
And we have people from the Department of Transportation. I know that.
Here or on the phone?
Right here.
Here
I see Betsy Parker right there.
You're going to testify? If you are, have a seat at the table.
Or whoever from the department or the Department of Administration.
Well, here again, the claimant knows what is in their claim, so
yes,
proceed with your summary.
Right. This is Diane with the Subcommittee on Claims. Your claim is now being heard, so we're going to put you on the speakerphone, okay?
Okay,
great. And you'll be called. The chair will let you know when you are yours to speak, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is a claim by Ms. Rostrum, who lives in St. Paul, for damage to two tires on her Jaguar, a 2005 Jaguar. Coming back from Minneapolis on a day, the 14th of May of last year, apparently it was rush hour traffic. She hit what she described in her filing as a crater of a pothole, which destroyed both the front and back tire on one side. The cost of replacing the tires at Tires Plus was $276.26, and that's the amount of the claim. She was eastbound coming from the Minneapolis direction on Interstate 94. There were new lane shifts because of an upcoming resurfacing project. She was near the Cretan exit. And her argument, at least in the papers she filed, was that the fact that the department fixed this pothole immediately after she called to report it indicates that the pothole definitely needed fixing. Now, the only other interesting thing on a case on a claim like this is that we have in the past, and unfortunately I have this institutional history in my brain, we have in the past paid two similar claims. One was in the 2001 claims bill to a person named Joanne Danelski. She had $439 of damage to her car up in Duluth when she hit severely deteriorated curbing. One of the drivers just prior to her knocked this curbing into the roadway and she ran into it. The department's response was, the moment we found out the curbing was in the roadway, we fixed it. And on the other hand, the subcommittee was very sympathetic to Ms. Danelski, and they paid $439 coming from the general fund for the Department of Transportation to pay to Ms. Danelski. The other claim is one that I'll recall because I remember Senator Randy Kelly being so enthusiastic about it. This was in 1996 when Senator Kelly was chair of the Claims Subcommittee. It was paid to Greg Chartier of St. Paul, who damaged his vehicle at an exit ramp from I-35W in Minneapolis. And again, that was a situation where he hit a pothole and ruined the front end of his Oldsmobile. And so we paid $500 for repairs to his Oldsmobile from the general fund to the Department of Transportation to pay to this person. The department's response once again was, the moment we found out about the pothole, we fixed it. And so the only question then is whether that is all the response. I mean, I understand that they can't fix something unless they know that it needs to be fixed. But twice in the past, this subcommittee has paid these claims.
Is Mr. Lindecki, in your opinion, is there any difference between the Bostrom claim and the previous two claims that you referred to?
Mr. Chair, I don't see much difference between the three claims, particularly the other pothole claim back in 96.
Testimony? Before you proceed, Ms. Bostrom, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
You've heard us. We're discussing your claim here at the Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims. Go ahead and summarize your position, please.
Well, I appreciate that the DOT came and repaired this, but, you know, anybody who drove along I-94 realized that there were these big ruts that were running along, you know, actually the lane lines. And I think, you know, certainly speaking for myself, I knew to avoid them, you know, when I had to cross lanes, which I rarely did in that area if I could avoid it, just because these ruts were so large. But when the lane shifts happened, and they had just happened a couple of days previously, it completely moved those ruts that we knew to avoid along the lane lines to the drivable area of the lanes. And you know, because I guess, you know, the frustration was that because these ruts were so large, and because that was one of the reasons why the road was being resurfaced, that, you know, at least there hadn't been some temporary fill put in some of the larger ones, you know, knowing that this was an issue, you know, so that people like me could avoid it. I mean, I couldn't even see this because, you know, rush hour and the cars being so close together, there was no way for me to have been able to see it and avoid it. And it was frightening. I mean, I hit that. I mean, I called it a crater, but, you know, I mean, it really, I mean, my car went down, you know, it came up, and I was concerned not just about my tires, but about, you know, the underside of my car. And I guess, you know, the issue for me was, why weren't these, you know, why weren't some of these larger ones at least, again, temporarily filled? And there was just no way that I could have avoided this one. And it was way beyond the average pothole.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you tell us who you are? And we have a witness at the table, so we'll hear from her next. Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay.
I am Betsy Parker from the Department of Transportation. I'm filling in for the people from our tort claims office this morning because they're at the funeral of a colleague. The department's position about this is that it was not negligent in its care of the road. We do not deny that there was a pothole there. We filled it within 1/2 hour of being notified of the existence of the pothole. But given the amount of road miles in the state and the occurrence of potholes, which are the effect of weather and traffic and other things, it's impossible for the department to be present in every location at every minute with a truck to fill potholes. And so we feel that we have developed a very good process for addressing this issue. As soon as it's possible to fill a pothole and we receive notice of it, we do that. And we believe that when we follow that process, that we are not negligent. We have not failed to do a duty that belongs to us and therefore should not be held liable for paying the claim. The records indicate that in 2010 there were 253 pothole claims, and the department did pay 10 of them. It investigates each and every claim to determine when it got notice of the claim and how quickly, or when it got notice of the pothole and how quickly the department responded. And if there's any indication that the department failed to respond as quickly as possible, then the department does pay the claim and feels that that's appropriate. But it would be, I think, extremely difficult for us to pay every claim because of the difficulty. And the legislature has endorsed that policy, I think, by the exception in the State Tort Claims Act. The legislature has acknowledged that the department and the state should not pay claims when it is not negligent. And so that's the department's basis for denying this claim. The claim was investigated by the Department of Administration Risk Management Unit, which puts another set of eyes on our claim, and they recommended that the claim not be paid.
Ms. Bostrom, you've heard the testimony. Do you have anything to say in response?
Well, I guess, you know, this is not, you know, without knowing your business, this doesn't seem like the average pothole claim. You know, and it certainly, you know, doesn't help somebody who has hit a pothole for it to be filled retroactively. Again, I appreciate that they were responsive, but, you know, the issue is different here. These were known issues with the stretch of I-94, and when the lane shift was done and, you know, the surface was restriped, there would have been ample opportunity for anybody who was working on the road to see, you know, where some of these larger potholes were, and again, you know, put some temporary fill in until the resurfacing project could be done so that people didn't damage their cars.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Simon and Wardlow and Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a question for the department. First of all, you have this procedure in place. You say that you processed 253 pothole claims. Does the public know about that? Or the better question to ask is, how, if at all, do you publicize that? I didn't know that before yesterday, that there's a process in place for people to make claims.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, there might be someone behind me who knows more about this, but it's my understanding that we have a website that tells people that they can file a claim about the location of a pothole. I think that we often, when we issue news releases about road conditions, we often mention that we want the public to tell us where the potholes are. And I myself have seen on the 10 o'clock news at night reporters interviewing MnDOT employees, and the MnDOT employees standing by the side of a road and saying that we encourage people to call the department and here's the phone number. And I believe there have been times when WCCO, for example, I don't know about the others, has had a link on their link website where you can connect not only to report potholes to MnDOT, but to Minneapolis and St. Paul as well. And because this has been such a difficult year because of the weather this year, that has been widely publicized in the news media. So I do think that people know, most people know, that they can report it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I'm wondering, though, more specifically, not about the reporting hotline, but the claims process.
Oh, the claims process.
The process by which a person can allege that their vehicle was damaged.
I'm not sure how people find that out. We have an information help desk where people can call. I'm fairly certain that person would know to tell the person to call our tort claims office. We have a website that people can search that has topics by in alphabetical order so that people could go there. If they called the Department of Administration, they would probably be told to file a claim. I don't know how Ms. Brostrom found out about the claims procedure in this case.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. And Ms. Brostrom, if you can hear me, have you attempted to resolve this with the department before coming to this committee?
Yes, that's why I think it's at this committee. I had filed the claim, and I have to say I'm pretty adept. I do a lot of online research as part of my job, and I'm pretty adept at going through websites. I had heard that there was this program. I visited the website, and I spent probably 15 minutes searching, trying to find this, and finally ended up calling the department to find out where I would do this. And the person who was helping me was having a hard time, too, finding it, and finally came across it, and she had specific or the
Ms. Bostrom, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
You are breaking up to the point where we cannot understand what you're saying.
Okay.
I can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry. I probably wasn't speaking loudly enough. Do I need to repeat what I had said earlier?
Yes.
Well, just the last 15 seconds worth.
Okay. Just that it was difficult for me, who's an experienced web user, to find where to file the claim. And when I called the department, they had a hard time. The person who was helping me was having a hard time finding it, too, and finally had to give me the specific URL for that page in order to get to it, because there was no way that she could even easily explain to me, what links to click on the site. So I literally sat on the computer and, with her on the phone and typed in the URL so I could find the page to file the claim. It was not easy.
Anything else, Representative Wardle?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parker, I'm looking here at a picture of the affected area of Interstate 94 eastbound at Creighton and Vandalia, and it appears from this picture that you can see the significant rutting along the old lane lines. And a statement from the department here, or a submission from the department, states that the department couldn't have filled potholes at the beginning of the resurfacing project because they didn't form until after traffic had traveled over the new lane configuration when you shifted the lanes across the ruts. But in your opinion, do you think the department should have been reasonably able to discern that these rutted areas would break up and cause potholes to form if traffic was directed across them, especially given the harsh winter we've been having?
Start with a yes or no and then tell it in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wardlow, no. And the reason is because I think it's a true statement that although you can see that the pavement is not in good shape, there was in fact no pothole there when this picture was taken. And potholes form gradually over time. And perhaps after a day of rush hour traffic, the situation might have looked different. And that's the basis for the department's assertion that it's only liable if it knows there is a pothole there, not the possibility that there might be one, and fails to fix it when there knows there is a pothole there. There are many places where there might be a pothole later, but isn't at the time. And so we probably wouldn't be very useful for us to try to guess every location where a pothole might form later, because one might not form.
Representative Wardle, anything else?
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parker, are you aware of any instances where there have been ruts or lane line situations like this, and lane shifts have been implemented, and the department has taken measures to see that potholes don't form?
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wardlow, I'm not familiar with all of the construction projects that the department has had, so I probably would have to speculate about that.
Hi. Hello, to the committee.
Time for call a friend.
I'm Gene Lorenz, maintenance superintendent of Metro District. These black stripes on your picture here, those are actually repairs to the longitudinal tracks that occurred. Maintenance did these repairs back during the RNC period. We do those type of repairs every summer, and it does help. What happens during the paving process, you know, where you have these lanes that meet up with each other, that eventually they start to develop small cracks, and sometimes water gets in there, and it'll develop potholes. So we go maintenance after some of these start to develop, and we put these repairs to the longitudinal cracks. And that's what these black stripes are from, actually. We repaired many of those a few years before. So I don't know if that answers some of your questions or not as far as the what we do to prevent potholes from developing along these stretches.
Representative Wardle? Well,
thank you. That's helpful.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Weir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parker or Mr.
Gene.
Is there a duty by employees of the department or the Highway Patrol to report potholes?
Sure, there is. I mean, our employees, through the course of their daily activities, if they see them, they'll report them to their supervisor. The Highway Patrol also, we get reports from them as far as when potholes are developing. Our response always is to send someone out to investigate it and take a look at them, and if they warrant immediate repair, even during rush hour, if they become a hazard to the public and a hazard, anything that could cause property damage or injury to the public, we will fix them immediately. Now, sometimes we get a heat because of that, because if it's during rush hour and it's a hazard, we treat that just like a car in the lane. And we'll go out there with maybe the Highway Patrol help, and we'll fix the pothole immediately. Some of them don't warrant immediate repair, and then we'll get them after rush hour traffic or maybe after hours, those type of times. Senator Reeder, anything else?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And there's camera surveillance of quite a bit of the highway system, and you would be able to detect potholes through the surveillance as well?
It's pretty tough with the camera system to see the potholes. We have a better feel of it, better reporting. If someone visually actually looks at it, they can determine how deep it is and whether it is a hazard or not. We get very few tips on potholes actually through the camera systems.
Finally, Mr. Chair, do we ever get subrogation requests from insurance companies after they've made payment on claims?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weger, I don't know the answer to that question.
My name is Brian Freeman.
We're recording, so
I'm with the Risk Management Division, and I handle claims for MnDOT, like of this nature, and maybe I could shed some light on that. What my experience is in handling claims for MnDOT of this nature is that, yes, sometimes we do get what's called subrogation claims by insurance companies for damage to their vehicles from potholes, and we do, generally speaking, we follow, my division follows what the Department of Transportation decision on the claim is. And sometimes the forum for addressing a denial, if it is a denial, is through conciliation court or district court, which in my opinion, is the forum that, under the statute 3.736, this claim should have been referred to. But, I mean, I'm not questioning your authority or your ability to hear this. I'm just saying that is my opinion. So to answer your question, yes, we do get subrogation claims from insurance companies relative to pothole damage to vehicles.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question of the gentleman from the Department of Transportation again?
I'm going to ask him one, too.
All right.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, my question is specifically about the pothole that she hit with her Jaguar. Mm-hmm. She said she was in rush hour traffic. It was 6:30, yeah. It was certainly a rush hour time coming from Minneapolis on the interstate. She couldn't see ahead of her that there might be a pothole that she should avoid because of the traffic all around her. Is it possible or is it likely? You filled this pothole within half an hour after being notified. Is it possible that there was this, let's use the word she used, crater-sized pothole that she hit and that ruined two of her tires at that time on that day?
I don't doubt that there. I mean, we'd had a truck go out there. They reported they found a pothole and they fixed it. So the pothole was there in that area. So I can't say that it wasn't there, and I wouldn't even attempt to say that it wasn't there.
Any answer you would have given would have been speculation, correct?
Sure.
Just out of curiosity, in the year 2010, how many total number? What was the total number of potholes filled in Minnesota?
In Minnesota, I don't have that information.
Give me a guess.
How many?
I'm going to ask you to speculate. I mean, there were 253 claims. I suspect there were more than 253 potholes in the state.
What I can do is give you an estimate of how many we fill in the metro area. If you give me a minute here, and I do some figuring.
Go ahead.
May I interject something,
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chairman, committee, based on the claim form that Ms. Brostrom completed, I mean, this happened at 6:15 p.m. on May 14, 2010. I believe that would be daylight hours at that time. I mean, it wouldn't be dark at that time. That would be just my thought. As far as she says it's unavoidable, she couldn't see it, well, that's the only comment I have.
Mr. Lawrence?
I can say, like, in the metro area alone, that's the only figures I can give you, that we fix approximately, just on the state highways in the metro district, maybe around 20,000 potholes through the course of the year.
Any other questions from anyone on the committee? Any other testimony? I see none. Ms. Bostrom, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
We're going to lay the matter over and make a decision sometime today, and you'll be notified of the result after today. Thank you for being on the phone.
All right. Thank you so much for hearing my claim.
Lindecki, go ahead. What's next?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, the remaining claims are claims against the Department of Corrections. And the first group of claims are the injury claims. Actually, the first request is a request written by Ms. Nicole Lind requesting money as reimbursement of money already paid by the department to conditionally released offenders sentenced to serve and community work service individuals during the past year. The first request that she sent us was dated December 14th and requested $2,575.99. The update on April 4th added another $896.28, so that the total that I come to is $3,472.27. Reimbursement to the department for small claims already paid and medical expenses paid. This is a routine thing that we approve every year and put in the claims bill as item paragraph A of section 1 when we get to the Department of Corrections.
You are Nicole Lind?
Nicole Lind with the Department of Corrections.
Yes, Linda, do you have this document? This is our agenda.
I do believe I do.
I'm looking at your portion of it.
Okay.
property claim? Are we on property claims?
Mr. Chair, let's not do the property claims yet. We'll do the injury claims. But in my book, right before that, was this request for money from the department.
Oh, I see. The
reimbursement. For reimbursement.
Right.
So that's why I went to that item first.
All right. And under this portion of the agenda, the individual claimants are not named. It's just summation of claims paid.
It is just claims paid, but on the back of each of these pages from Ms. Lind, you can see the names and the amounts paid and when they paid them.
Ms. Lind, go ahead.
Representative Smith, what Mr. Lindeke said is correct. These are claims that were already paid out for offenders that were injured during performing community work service, and these are the amounts that we paid out, and they are amounts at medical assistance rates.
What's the total number of claimants, individuals, that comprise this $3,400 amount?
Is it around 30, Ms. Lind?
Correct.
I don't know exact. I counted kind of 30.
Any further testimony from anyone?
Okay.
Any further testimony from anybody?
No.
Any questions from the committee? All right. Let's move to the next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is actually a burn injury to Shah Aziz, who is at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Stillwater. The injury took place a couple of years ago, and he injured his right forearm on a steam pipe in the kitchen. And what we do in these cases in order to determine whether there is a permanent partial disability is wait 2 years for maximum healing on these burn injuries. There was an examination November 10th of last year in which the doctor gave us the specific amount of scarring. And in the letter from Mr. Hartnett, who is here from the Department of Corrections, he explains that the amount of injury is not sufficient to add up to a permanent partial disability on this particular individual.
Mr. Hartnett, we have your letter suggesting that this matter should not be paid. Do you have anything to add? Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Randy Hartnett from the Department of Corrections, Mr. Chair. The 2-year waiting period that Mr. Lindeke referred to is built into Minnesota Rules Chapter 5223. That's the permanent injury schedule used for workers' compensation processes. And with regard to burn injuries, when those injuries are cosmetic in nature and they're not on the dorsum of the hands, the top part of the hand, the neck, or the face, they have to meet a criteria of, I believe, 5% of the surface area. And the forearm, the rules also require the use of a particular medical schedule called the Method of London Browder to determine what percentage of body surface area is comprised of a particular body part, and the forearm in its entirety is 3%, so that doesn't meet the criteria. In this case, the claimant's injuries were small scars on his forearm.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like to point out that, because Mr. Hartnett mentioned the workers' compensation system and the rules and the statutes and all of that, we are not, we the subcommittee and the Department of Corrections are not operating under workers' compensation as a system, and it's not, but we, because there are such wonderful tables and charts and every little injury is accounted for at some percentage. We use, as a convenience to the subcommittee, we use the workers' compensation system to determine how much of a permanent partial disability there is for for someone and how much to pay the individual.
So there is precedent that this subcommittee has relied on the workers' compensation summary of percentages necessary to meet payment claims. But I just heard.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And they've done it for the 17, 18 years, whatever it is I've been on the subcommittee. It's just so much easier to use the workers' compensation
and Mr.
percentages.
Hartnett, excuse me. And Mr. Hartnett, using those percentages in statute, your testimony that I just heard tells me that he does not meet the percentage requirement for a claim. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any questions from the committee? I think we'll delay this over and get on to the next item. Can I ask the folks in the back, are you here on a particular claim?
Yes, Mario Versiaga.
Next
Mr. Chair, it's the next claim.
I was going to move your claim up, but I think we're approached that point anyway.
Mr. Chair, there is a claim in between Mr. Versiaga's, and that's the claim of a juvenile going by the initials of SB.
We have that later on. Is that... Perhaps is someone here for SB?
SB. Oh, I see.
But
claim SB juvenile 10-PI-154. Anybody here on that case? Why are we discussing it then?
Mr. Chair, perhaps we ought to go to Mario Bosiaga.
All right.
Because he's got people here.
That's what we're going to do.
The only question is, where would you like us?
Somewhere in the room. How about
bring an extra chair up to the table so the two of you can sit there with Mr. Hartnett.
We'll get you right up at the table. That's what I should have said.
Mr. Versiaga is, as I understand it, represented by an attorney.
That's correct. For the record, Walter Kaminsky here on behalf of Mr. Versiaga. I'm with the law firm of Lindell and Lavoie in Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair, could I summarize the claim?
Yes, please go ahead, and then we'll go to testimony.
Mr. Versiaga was doing sentencing to service work in Rice County, was injured by a wood splitter while working at Sakata State Park. I'm not sure how to pronounce Sakata. I guess I've never been there. The injured the fingers of his right hand, which involved amputation of his small finger. The department has come up with a percentage of 4% permanent partial disability at $3,000 and medical expenses that should be paid at the medical assistance rate to medical providers of $1,914.73. And my understanding is that Mr. Bursiaga's attorney would argue that it's a 5% permanent partial disability, which I figure at $3,750. Is that correct?
Mr. Kaminsky.
Partially correct. Our claim is for more than the amount of $3,750 for the permanent injury.
What's your amount you're claiming?
The amount we're requesting is $28,750.
Since we're discussing the amount, what makes up that figure of $28,750?
Mr. Versiaga is here, and with your permission, I would like for him to approach and show you his pinky at some point during these proceedings. As you indicated from the previous claim, there's been a longstanding tradition of this body to look at the workers' compensation tables. I do believe that there have been other cases where you have awarded without regard to those tables, and I believe that based upon the circumstances here and based upon the type of injury, the amount that we are requesting is appropriate.
Well, that was a non-responsive answer. How do you arrive at $28,750?
It's based upon other cases. We are a personal injury firm. We are a workers' compensation firm. And based upon the type of injury, looking at other cases that have settled in the private sector with the type of injury that Mr. Versiaga has, we believe that the value of an amputation of a right pinky is well beyond that of $3,750.
What part of the $28,750, if any, represent total medical costs? You have that number?
And again, just to clarify, the $28,750 would be above and beyond, in addition to the amount of the medical expenses that we have submitted to this subcommittee. There should be a letter dated March 1st of 2011, where we have a breakdown of $27,994.18 of medical expenses aside from the permanent injury. Now, Mr. Hartnett did provide a response to that, and he is suggesting that those bills be paid at the medical assistance rate because Mr. Bursiaga did not have medical insurance, nor does he have medical insurance at this time.
So medical expenses actually incurred were $27,906.18, according to your letter. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, initially we received bills from providers, the Orthopedic and Fracture Clinic, the District 1 Hospital, which I believe is in Faribault, and the North Memorial Ambulance, and that was for two ambulance trips. We had obtained the medical assistance amounts on those bills. Of those bills, Mr. Kaminsky had submitted the District 1 and the North Memorial Ambulance bills. I believe his packet didn't have the Orthopedic and Fracture Clinic. I suspect that was a professional charge for reading x-rays. Mr. Kaminsky, however, did submit bills to us from the Mayo Clinic totaling, as billed, $21,000 and change, and then bills for psychiatric services from the Alina Clinic. Those bills came to us in March of this year, and when they were submitted, they didn't have the codes that we are required to have in order to get the medical assistance analysis on that. So at this point, we're still trying to determine what the medical assistance payment would be. If it's not too early to make a recommendation in that, I would ask either that the subcommittee, if they decide that these bills should be paid at the MA rate, allow us to speak with Mr. Lindeke if those come in prior to the deadline for the claims bill, or to pay those in our under $500 claim process. I'm guessing from my experience that the medical assistance for those bills will be in the neighborhood of $7,000.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I just say that it's not a matter of, and we don't have a choice on the medical assistance rates. That's what the statute requires the subcommittee to pay on prisoner and sentenced to service injury claims, medical assistance rates.
And that's understood.
All right.
And again, what Mr. Hartnett summarized is located on page 3 of his March 15, 2011 letter that he submitted.
So, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, we'll be getting some more amounts to add to the $1,914.73, will have some more expenses at medical assistance rates to pay when we actually put together the bill, hopefully next week. So I hope we can get those numbers fairly soon, Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, my paralegal tells me that the codes came from the Mayo Clinic at the early part of this week, and she submitted them to our contact at the DHS and asked that those be done in an expedited manner.
So the current number is 1,900 what?
$1,914.73 plus.
Okay. Any questions from... Do you have any anything you want to offer, or are you done?
Two more comments.
Go ahead.
The Department of Corrections evaluated this based upon a 4% under the work comp tables, and we're evaluating it based upon a 5% under the work comp tables if you're going to apply those tables. And again, the distinction, as I understand it, has to do with where the actual amputation occurs, whether it's above the knuckle or below the knuckle. And again, you can look for yourself and see where the amputation is on Mr. Bursiaga. As far as the other portion, We did put a paragraph in our letter, and again, our letter is dated March 1st of 2011, and part of the reason why we are asking for the amount that we are asking for has to do with how this injury unfolded. To a certain extent, we understand that this is a no-fault system that's been established. However, we would invite this committee and the Department of Corrections to review their sentence-to-serve procedures. Here we have a situation where Mr. Burciaga was in the Rice County Jail for a controlled substance crime. He was doing a certain amount of jail time, and he did qualify for the sentence-to-serve program in that facility. It was signed off by a judge. It was signed off by the county attorney himself. And curiously, the sentence-to-serve program that they have in Rice County pairs up county inmates with Department of Corrections prison inmates. So we have Mr. Burciaga, who has little or no experience with log splitting, operating a chainsaw out in Sakata State Park, performing this very dangerous activity. In most of the counties that I'm familiar with, and I speak as a former Sherburne County attorney, I know that the sentence-to-serve programs oftentimes deal with the typical picking up garbage on the side of the road or cleaning up facilities for the government center and those types of activities. This seems to me to be a fairly high-risk activity that inmates are being exposed to. And to a certain extent, that's the only option that's provided under a sentence-to-serve program in Rice County.
Mr. Chair? Well, we see the ones that we see that come to this subcommittee on claims of sentencing to service and community work service people seem always to involve some piece of a tree falling on someone or cutting things down, and this happens an awful lot. So apparently it's not just in this county or something like that. It takes place around the state, and there's an awful lot of this that goes on in sentencing to service programs.
Mr. Kaminsky, anything further you care to offer?
Mr. Chair, I have one more question. There's still this dispute. Let's leave this $28,750 aside for a moment and talk about the difference between what Mr. Kaminsky calls the absurd amount of $3,750 and apparently the even more absurd amount of $3,000 that Mr. Hartnett is proposing. On seeing his hand and finger now, Mr. Hartnett, to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, Mr. Burciaga, that is what the photographs that I looked at appeared to be. And I looked at the surgical report, which indicated that the amputation, this was what's called a completed amputation. And Mr. Burciaga, I know this is your finger. I apologize for talking about it in a clinical matter, the report from the surgeon said that the amputation was completed at the proximal interphalangeal joint, and the 4% is the rating that I could see in the workers' comp schedules for that. There is a rating of 5.5% for an amputation of the small finger at the metacarpal joint, which is the joint where the finger reaches the hand, so there would be no stump of a little finger in that particular situation. Now, there is a 5% total value of the small finger for a complete amputation that serves as a limit. If, for example, there are musculoskeletal injuries that add up, the workers' comp schedules says that sum cannot exceed what is known as the value of the digit, which is 5%. And I suspect that that's where the 5% comes from, because that is listed in the schedules as being the value of the small finger. My 4% was based on the surgical report. Any medical report obviously has an element of subjectivity to it.
So, Mr. Chair, the two of you still disagree about 4% or 5%.
Is that correct?
Well, it appears that, you know, from the surgical report, and you know, obviously I'm not a physician myself. I can't make a diagnosis from looking at Mr. Bersiaga's finger, but it does appear that it was not an amputation at the metacarpal joint, which is this joint here. And so I assume that that if that the rating would be at 4% because that's where the injury took place, is at this particular knuckle, the first knuckle.
Any questions from the committee?
I think that'd be a good idea if Senator Jungbauer is willing to unless he has some questions.
Came in here late to me. Apologize to everyone. I had a little run-in with a car last week, so I had some doctor's appointments this morning. So I'm a little out of joints and under the weather, so to speak. So I'll have to play catch-up real quick. Does anybody want to just bring me up to speed on what's the difference on this one again?
Mr. Lindick, you gave a brief summary. Would you repeat?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, this individual who is right here with us, Mario Bersiaga, and his attorney is Mr. Kaminsky. He was injured doing sentence to service work in Rice County. He was working in Sakata State Park.
I remember reading it, so you could just bring up the speed on what the difference was again.
Now the difference is that although we have $1,914.73 at the medical assistance rate that have already been acknowledged, there are more bills coming. So we will hope to have those by next Monday when I am putting together a delete everything amendment, and presumably whatever motion we make today will include those additional costs at medical assistance rate. And then the other dispute is between Mr. Hartnett and Mr. Kaminsky over whether it's a 4% or a 5% permanent partial disability. And Mr. Hartnett argues that if the cut was at this, and you can see his finger there, the cut was at this second knuckle, that would be a 4% disability, and that the loss maybe down here or of the whole finger would be a 5%. That seems to be the argument, and Mr. Kaminsky feels that the workers' compensation amount, whether $3,750 or $3,000, is way too small for the significance of an injury like this.
So what I'm hearing then, Senator and others, is that the department giving testimony today is suggesting the combined numbers of $1,914.73 plus, as they come in at medical assistant rates for the bills, and then a 4% rating or award in the sum of $3,000. So those two numbers together, adjusted by incoming bills, is the amount suggested that this committee proceed with if it chooses to pay.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I estimate that the remaining bills from the Mayo Clinic will be in the neighborhood of $7,000, but that's just based on a rough estimate that these things come in at about one-third.
So roughly $3,200 today with an additional $7,000 potential,
I don't know,
you think, correct? Question, I was done. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $7,000, is that the MA rate or is that the total?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that is what I estimate that the MA rate will be for that $21,000 bill. Trying to determine an MA rate is an incredibly complex process. My predecessor at the department used to go through computer printouts that were literally a foot thick to try and determine that. By the time I came in, we were asking an individual at the medical assistance unit of the Department of Human Services to do that for us. That particular individual, who, by the way, has been doing it for us for the 16 years I've been working for the department without any additional remuneration, she's required to have certain codes that are known as HCPCS codes. And most medical providers will provide us with those HCPCS codes so that the MA rate can be determined directly. In this case, the bills from the Mayo Clinic did not have the codes, and my paralegal obtained those codes earlier this week and submitted them to our contact at the DHS.
Representative Simon.
Comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is we are constrained by the MA rate. I mean, we really can't go beyond that, regardless of what other factors, including justice, would require. So, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Lindeke, I think we're constrained by that. So,
Mr. Chair, I think we are constrained by the medical assistance rate.
And so, Mr. Chair, that the issue for us now is, it seems to me anyway, we know that there are going to be other bills forthcoming. The real question, the remaining question, it seems to me, is whether it's 4% or 5%. And then we just...
Senator Jim Bauer.
Well, then on that 4 or 5%, are we also constrained by the work comp figures in terms of the payout based on that percentage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we're not per se constrained. But the fact is, for 18 years, we have used it because it's a convenient way of valuing injuries to a person.
Well, so it sounds like precedent.
Yes. So then I will make a statement from personal experience, having had a permanent partial disability of my back, and actually several of them paid at the work comp rate. Nobody's going to get hurt to get paid at the work comp rate. But since there's an argument between 4 and 5%, I would move that we use the 5%.
Any discussion? So you're moving payment of the claim at a 5%?
At a 5% rate of disability.
Motion is before us. Any discussion? All right. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Case is over.
Okay, thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll expect to hear from Mr. Hartnett on the details of those additional bills.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, in that regard, if there, in fact, is a delay, would the subcommittee grant us leave to pay that and request reimbursement next year if it comes beyond the date that Mr. Lindeke has to submit the delete all bill?
Unless there's no discussion, I think by consensus we can, if there's no challenge, we'll just incorporate that in the motion we just passed.
All right.
That prevents the provider from having to wait an additional year for payment.
Very good, gentlemen. If there's nothing further, this case is closed. We'll move on to the next one. Is there anyone in the room that's here on another case? I don't see any hands shooting up. All right, well, then let's just
Mr. Chair, the next case is Natalie Clark. She was doing sentence to service work in Hennepin County, was struck by tree branches. The medical expenses are $1,403.18 at the medical assistance rate. And fortunately, there is no ratable permanent partial disability at this time.
So the total claim is for $1,403.18
for Natalie Clark,
sentenced
to serve in Hennepin County.
Testimony?
Mr. Chair, what Mr. Lindeke says is accurate. On the 3rd of March, I sent a letter to Mr. Paul Rambo, who, in addition to being Ms. Clark's attorney in this matter, was Ms. Clark's employer. And let him know this was what my recommendation would be, and ask him to submit any additional claim he might have for permanency. I haven't heard anything from Mr. Rambo. I don't know whether or not he was still representing Ms. Clark because she'd relocated to California in the interim. I wasn't working in that firm anymore.
When was your communication with him again?
On March 3rd, 2011.
All right. And so are you disputing the number?
I am not disputing the number. In reviewing the medical records, it did not appear to me that there was a ratable permanency evidenced in the medical records. That's what I told Mr. Rambo, and that's what my recommendation was. I haven't received anything that disputes that.
Any questions from the committee? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I move that we recognize appropriate monies to pay a claim of $1,403.18.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is Mary Hatcher, who was doing sentence to service work in Olmsted County, working on the Orinoco City Hall. She slipped on some steps, hit her left elbow. The elbow already had a fracture that was in the process of being repaired. Apparently, the fracture, the fracture was unchanged. She has recovered. The medical expenses in this case are $767.54 at the medical assistance rate, and there is apparently no permanent partial disability related to this particular fall.
So the total claim is, what's the number?
$767.54.
Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, we have a straggler bill in this claim that we received medical assistance amount, and the clerk has just passed it out to the members there. It puts an additional medical assistance payment of $267.80 for a total medical payment of $1,035.34, and that would be my amended recommendation.
So, how much is the amount, and what's the total?
The new amount is $267.80, Mr.
Lindeke. Yes.
And that totals $1,035.34 when added to the previous recommendation. Okay.
So, Mr. Hartnett, you do not dispute the validity of the claim?
No, I do not.
The number is, as you just stated, $1,035.34.
That's correct.
Any questions from the committee? Is there a motion?
I would move that we pay the bill, undisputed amount, at $1,035.34 for Mary Hatcher.
Any discussion of that? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is a claim of Scott LaCroix, who was a prisoner at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Stillwater, working in the metal shop when the grinder jerked back into his left hand on the 9th of March last year. Sutures were required, and the sutures were ultimately removed. There is, of course, a minor scar where the sutures were. Mr. Hartnett tells us there's no permanent partial disability.
Mr. Hartnett, what is the MA cost on this?
Mr. Chair, for claims submitted by individuals who were injured while working at our facilities, there is no medical claim at all because the department is required to take care of all of our prisoners' medical requirements. And so when these injuries are occurred, those are taken care of in the general course of the fact that somebody is incarcerated. So the department doesn't charge any additional costs for taking care of these. In a case where an individual is injured while working at the prison but is required to undergo medical treatment beyond their period of incarceration, we have generally recommended that it be paid at the medical assistance rate, but in this case there are no medicals because the individual was in prison at the time he was treated.
So, Mr. Chair, the only time we actually see medical assistance rate payments is in the sentencing to serve and community work service claims.
President Simon, you had a question?
Yeah, just a quick question. I noticed that the claimant states that there's some permanent nerve, or he didn't say permanent, he says severe nerve damage to the middle finger. Do we know anything about that?
Mr. Hardin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that was his claim. If you bear with me,
last year, yeah.
Check the timing. That was on the 24th of August of last year. The medical records don't indicate that there was any complaint of nerve or motor damage through the time that the injury was sutured and the sutures were being followed to make sure that no infection set in. This was treated with sutures, partial reopening about a week later. Throughout the period of treatment, there was no mention of loss of sensation. Following the date, there was no mention at all of the finger, despite the claimant having been treated several times for another unrelated injury.
So I don't believe that there was any medical evidence of nerve damage.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I move that we deny this claim.
Motion before us. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Claim is denied. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of Sean Noring, who was doing sentence to service work in Aitkin County and was, oddly enough, shingling up on the roof of the Aitkin Library, shingling the roof, and fell 10 feet. And we're lucky that there wasn't much more injury than pain in the neck and back. Medical expenses involved in this claim are $3,675.10, according to the department's letter of March 4th at medical assistance rates. No permanent partial disability in this case, fortunately, but this individual is starting to claim that he's having spinal symptoms. So it's possible that if later on some permanent partial disability shows up, we may have to reopen this case and deal with the permanent partial disability.
Mr. Hardner, your comments on this matter?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke is correct. This individual did sustain a fall from approximately 10 feet. The treating physician actually expressed surprise in the medical records that he wasn't exhibiting more symptoms than he was. But there was nothing in the medicals other than that he was released to work without any activities, and he was told he might have delayed soreness for 2 days, but could work. In the 2 years intervening, we had heard nothing more from Mr. Noring. We sent the letter to the claims subcommittee with a copy of it to Mr. Noring and Mr. Bailey, who was an attorney that Mr. Noring had consulted at the beginning of it. Following that letter going out, we got a call from I'm afraid I don't remember the name of the medical provider, but saying that Mr. Noring was now asking to be treated for pain that he had 2 years hence. My paralegal contacted them to let them know that we weren't an insurance company and therefore couldn't approve or disapprove medical treatment like an insurance company could. And the provider said that Mr. Noring had sought treatment on the recommendation of his attorney.
Mr. Hardin, do you deny the validity of this claim?
I do not deny the validity of the claim as presented, Mr. Chair. I would reserve the department's right to review any additional medical claims, either for additional treatment or for permanency, that we don't currently have any evidence for.
And that's I understood that. So the number we have currently that you're suggesting is correct.
That is the MA rate on all the bills we've received so far.
3675.10.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there any questions? Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hardin, so if this claim comes for delayed injury, does the department then go back and actually request medical records to find out if anything else was on the file in terms to make
yes.
certain? Okay.
Yeah, it's possible that in some cases claimants will not go to the doctor because they're not in the habit of doing so. In this particular case, I suspect that the counsel suggested that this gentleman go to make sure that nothing was wrong. This process that we have, and I've been dealing with this almost as long as Mr. Lindeke has, individuals are not barred from representing a claim once it's come before the board if, in fact, there's new medical evidence. We would just simply ask that we be allowed to review it in the same manner that we would have had it been presented at the beginning.
Mr. Lindeke, assuming we have a motion to accept the validity of the claim at 3675.10, would we have a motion to pay as they come in, or can we just simply reopen the case when he gets the numbers, which would be my preference?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would put 367510 in the upcoming delete everything amendment to the bill.
And see what happens.
And then we'll see what happens.
That's a good idea.
Mr. Chair, if I may be presumptuous enough, our recommendation would be to do that too. The situation where I asked for permission to pay out of the under 500 was a situation where we had already reviewed the medical information. We simply were waiting for medical bills to come in. In this case, I don't have any idea whether Mr. Noring's current treatment results from this accident or whether it resulted from a subsequent injury that was unrelated.
Then I will move that we pay the $36.75.10 for Sean Noring as currently before us.
That's the motion before us. Any discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of Aaron Osten, who is a prisoner at Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault. On November 30th of 09, working in the wood shop, he cut himself on the left forearm. It was a fairly significant cut. Mr. Hartnett has determined that it's a 4.5% permanent partial disability, and that is $3,375 paid to the individual. And I want to remind people, we met with all of you in your offices, and I hope we talked about this, but any payment to a prisoner or to actually each of these medical providers goes first to the Revenue Recapture Act to see if the person owes back taxes, child support, judgments, payments to the victims, whatever they take out of the Revenue Recapture Act. Yeah.
Mr. Hartnett, your position on this claim?
Mr. Chair, we initially presented this claim a year ago on the 4th of March of 2010. At that time, Mr. Osten was still treating with a physical therapist at our facility. He had a fairly severe cut to that was his wrist, I believe. And at the time, the last physical therapist remarks made said that he still had some slight weakening of his grip strength. That was not, there wasn't a specific categorization under the workers' comp schedules for a tendon nick, which apparently this was a partially cut tendon. However, what appeared to be the most closely related, and that is permitted under the rules to make a rating based on the most closely related loss of function, was that loss of function for a partial loss of ulnar nerve distribution, resulting in a minor loss of grip strength, and that's where the 4.5% rating comes from.
So are you admitting the validity of the claim?
Admitting the validity of the claim and recommending that the permanency be paid at that amount, yes.
$33.75.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Chair, I move that we approve the claim and recommend.
Senator Wieger beat you to it.
We did. Been here.
We'll turn this way next time. Motion before us, any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of Christopher Pearson, who was doing sentence to service work in Isanti County when an extension ladder fell and hit him on the head. It hurt for a while, apparently. There's no permanent partial disability. But medical expenses involved in this were $1,139.74 at medical assistance rates.
Mr. Hartnett, do you deny the validity of his claim?
Mr. Chair, I do not. My recommendation is to pay by way of explanation. The medical expenses include a fairly extensive drug screen that the medical facility provided, and we don't take any argument with paying that because Mr. Pearson was apparently exhibiting some confusion shortly after being struck by the ladder, and I believe they wanted to screen to make sure there wasn't some additional chemical issue.
And you agree to the number amount previously stated?
That's correct.
Is there a motion, Representative Wardle?
We approve the claim and recommend appropriation of $1,139.34.
That's the motion before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of Michael Proell, P-R-O-E-L-L, doing sentenced to service work in Todd County on May 11th of 2009. He was cutting down a tree. It fell and hit him on the head. There's apparently no permanent partial disability in this case. I think we're fairly lucky on a number of these. But the medical expenses add up to $1,039.85 at medical assistance rates.
Mr. Hartnett, do you deny the validity of the claim?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Is that amount correct?
In my estimation, it is.
Representative Simon, you're losing out to other people who are making motions.
I'm a patient person.
Is there a motion on this one?
So,
Senator Wieger moves the claim be paid at the amount stated. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim by Anthony Reller, doing sentencing to service work in Carlton County. Pulling logs, I don't know how big they were, but it was enough to for him to pull his muscle and develop arm and shoulder pain. The medical expenses involved are $1,901.17 at medical assistance rates. I just point out that I may have mentioned this to each of you in your offices, and Representative Simon, I'm sure, knows it, that the reason why we wind up paying these medical expenses and these payments to people doing sentenced to service work is so that the counties are encouraged to actually have people out on sentencing to service rather than our having to have them in prison facilities. And this is a benefit to the county that we take care of the medical expenses for sentencing to service work. And part of the problem, of course, is are the county sentencing to service people well enough trained? And the department is responsible to train them to do safe actions with these people and to not have any more of these injuries than necessary.
Mr. Chair, I would like to expand on Mr. Lindeke's remarks a bit. Our department is involved in training with those sentenced to serve crews with which we have a relationship, usually a contractual relationship by way of a joint powers agreement. I provided the members with a summary that Mr. Solide had given us related to the training that is given to crew leaders to pass on to crew members. There is nothing that prohibits a county from starting their own program, and it's my understanding there are some programs that counties have that we are not involved with. They do their own training. They fall under the statute because of the definition of the statute. So far, the only cases that we have recommended denial on is individuals who are doing informal work in county jails without being allowed to, it not being in lieu of a fine or in lieu of time. Essentially, the county jail's equivalent of our inmate injury claims. And we've had a couple of cases where the county jails have said that that was the state's responsibility. Our recommendation was that it has not, that it was not. I know we've gone through that on a couple of occasions, but I just wanted to clarify that we provide the training with those crews that we have a contractual relationship with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I did want to just kind of make a personal note here that having read through most of these cases after being struck in a crosswalk by a car, I read through them with as much feeling as possible. But I was struck, as we heard, was that I think these folks must be trained pretty well and must do more teamwork because these injuries could have been much worse. I owned a construction business for 25 years and have seen much more. Whether you're clearing trees off a construction site, fall off a roof, I think we've been fortunate that some of these folks haven't been hurt worse, that they were taken care of right away. And so I think this is minimal to the state in terms of taking care of these things, and I'm grateful that we encourage the counties on the sentence to serve, to get them out to work. We want to take care of those folks so that they're trained well, they're taken care of well, and we can hopefully get them back out working in the real public as soon as possible when they're done with their sentence. So I like the information in here. It's my first crack at serving on the claims committee, and I think it's well documented for us, and so I was very thankful that you could make up your mind just through reading through.
So, Mr. Hartnett, I believe I asked you my two questions. The claim is okay and the numbers correct?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall there having been so many, but yes, that would be my response.
Chair moves approval of the claim. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of a minor, SB. And I gather we have it here because S comes at this point in our alphabetical list of people.
Well, we have it. I have it listed under B.
I understand why you would. doing sentence to service work in Hennepin County on June 15th of last year. Mowing the lawn on a sloped boulevard, the blade of the lawnmower cut the big toe of his left foot.
Cut it off?
How much did it cut off, Randy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, I believe in my letter, and this was by the report of the parents, because Hennepin County did not provide us with any additional medical information nor a release of information. I wrote a letter to the parents asking them to let me know if they disagreed with it, but it was a cutting of the large toe at about the middle of the toenail, and there was apparently some loss of bone. But it was the ratings for the large toe are actually quite limited. In the closest one would be the rating for amputation at the first joint, which is, of course, the large toe only has two knuckles, if you will, the first one and the one that would be the metatarsal one. And that would be a 4% permanency. His injury occurred prior to a change in the disability schedules, which would have required more medical information, because the demarcation there is insertion point of one of the tendons in that toe. But because of the date that this injury occurred, it appears to me that the fairest and closest is for amputation at that first knuckle, although I don't believe it was at that level. There was part of the nail bed and part of the bone removed. And I would also like to elaborate a little bit on the use of the initials. As the members will see, some of the medical reports in this thing do contain this juvenile's full name. That is for the subcommittee. The subcommittee's rules, however, require that for public purposes we just use the initials.
So the claim is valid?
At this point, Mr. Chair, it is.
And what's the amount?
And the amount would be a medical of $1,009.83, which is the bills we received at the medical assistance rate, and $3,000 for a 4% permanent partial loss to the large toe.
Senator John Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hartnett, we have... It was like an asterisk or something in our book on the 3,000. Was that for your explanation?
That was for the explanation about the insertion point of that flexor hilactus tendon.
Okay.
Is there a motion on this?
I will move that we pay this claim at the 3,000 rate for the 4% permanent partial disability and the $1,009.83 on the medical bills.
Motion before us made by Senator Jungbauer. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is a claim of Nicholas Tobin, a prisoner at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Faribault, working in the cabinet-making shop on September 24th of last year, cut the tip off his left thumb with the table saw. Apparently significant enough to be a 6.5% permanent partial disability to the tune of $4,875.
Mr. Hartnett, do you deny the validity of the claim?
I do not, Mr. Chair, and the permanency was my recommendation.
And the number you just heard is the correct number?
That's correct.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Simon?
I was just going to make a statement about that. And Representative Simon, you probably have more knowledge than maybe the rest of the committee, but I have pretty good knowledge of the work comp payout for disabilities, and this is one of those things, again, where you wonder why the tip of a thumb is more important than other fingers at some point, because these are issues for people down the road. So if anybody wondered why such a big discrepancy in those partial disabilities, read through that whole work comp thing. It's great reading to put you to sleep at night. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, prior to coming to work for the department, I was a staff attorney at the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals. And you're absolutely correct. The schedules have changed. They initially, historically, I believe, came from the American Medical Association disability schedules. There's a committee that reviews those. The Department of Labor and Industry goes through rulemaking to make changes to this, and the same as any other rule. And that is why, for example, on this large toe, the committee, in the face of new medical evidence in trying to measure exactly what the physical impairment related to the loss of part of the toe would be, changed their mind as to where the measurement should be. But we have followed our recommendations followed the workers' comp disability schedules, including the timing provisions.
And
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, some of these payouts were more significant. They were lowered partially to prevent fraud, and I want to be very clear, having had some of these work comp issues, I think they're down low enough where we can be pretty much assured nobody's cutting off their fingers or toes or other things just to try to get money, because it is not worth it to face a lifetime of any kind of disability under the work comp schedule as it currently stands. So,
is there a motion on this matter?
I will move that this be paid out at the rate of $48.75 to reflect the 6.5% permanent partial disability.
Motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Claim is approved. Next item.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the claim of DeLeon or DeLeon Walker, Minnesota Correctional Facility at Moose Lake, working in the print shop on February 8th of last year. And when you look at the pictures of this printing machine or this press, it looks dreadful. I'd hate to be working anywhere near it. But it took his left thumb. And there's a 13% permanent partial disability, $11,050 for the loss of your thumb.
This is 11%. Is it 13% or 11%?
I'm
reading 11%.
11. Well, I don't know. Which is it, Mr. Hartnett?
11%.
11%. And that, excuse me. It is 13%, Mr. Lindeke. I'm sorry, because there's a rating for the amputation and as well as a rating for motion, a loss of motion in the structure of the thumb that was still remaining. We applied there's a algebraic formula in the workers' comp law that you have to apply. So that 2.2% plus the 11% works out to 13%. It's not an estimate. It's what the algebraic formula comes up with.
Mr. Chair, when I wrote the summary on the claim, I read 11%. And then I read it yesterday again and came up with the 13% because I actually read Mr. Hartnett's letter again.
Okay, any questions?
The amount is correct.
Yes, this is a... Unfortunately, our most frequent claims at our prisons are amputation claims because of the industry program. To supplement Mr. Lindeke's remarks about the photographs, you should be aware that there was a metal plate guards over this mechanism at the time that this injury occurred. They were removed so that the mechanism inside the printer could be seen. It's my understanding that the claimant in this case was not following procedures and reached in to pull paper out without shutting the machine down.
So while the claim is for $200,000, your position is you're admitting the merits of the claim, but at the sum of $11,050.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We find that our offenders
In many cases, we'll claim $7,000 because that is the statutory maximum that a warden can settle without coming to this subcommittee. Or in other cases, they simply come up with a number, much the same as the gentleman's several million dollars that we talked about earlier.
Chair moves approval of the claim at the sum of $11,050. Representative Simon, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just for the future, too, it seemed to me this somewhat unique on our list because there was some, I guess you'd say, contributory negligence here. It seems like the guy didn't follow safety procedures, and there were signs there. On the other hand, there are also some questions about the machine. I don't know if they just are kind of awash that, you know, there was some corrective action taken, and I just don't know how to handle that. Maybe they cancel each other out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, we have, in the years that I've been doing this, looked at this as a non-fault-based system, which is the same as workers' comp. Often offenders will make assertions that there was a guard missing, and that simply isn't the case. What would happen in a private tort system is that machine would be sequestered, and it would be reviewed by experts, and there would be a determination whether or not there was contributory negligence, whether or not the machine was negligently maintained, or whether or not it was of negligent manufacture. And those sorts of things haven't been part of this system. So even though we do have offenders who don't follow the rules, we have never recommended denial because of that. And as Mr. Lindeke, after hearing some of the comments, the only time I have recommended denial is in cases where I believed, and that was one case, that the individual had cut his finger off purposefully.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hartnett or Mr. Lindeke. My assumption reading through this was that if we applied work comp, permanent partial disability, that we were probably looking at work comp rules, which, of course, wouldn't allow for that contributory negligence type of a thing. So is that kind of how we look at the whole situation then, or do we actually, if there was negligence, then we go back and allow for, if there was a finding in a cursory investigation, do we allow for that to come into the picture at that point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, the department is very aware of the need for safety. We have safety officers in each facility. We have a safety office at our central office. When we find a situation that we believe that there was a systemic issue or a machine that was improperly maintained or isn't working correctly, that's pulled off of there. So I don't want to give the subcommittee the impression that we ignore those sorts of things. We simply don't say, well, we believe this person should be paid more because the department did something they ought not to have done. And on the same token, we'd never say we don't believe that this individual should not be paid because they failed to follow the rules.
I guess, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. It doesn't really get to my point then. Do we assume this is treated as a workplace and as such we're kind of applying the whole statutory thought process of work comp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we take great pains to let the claimants on both sides, both the prison claimants and the STS claimants, know that this is not workers' comp. What will happen, particularly in STS, is a claimant will come in and they will tell the doctor, I got hurt working for the county. Of course, they may be embarrassed to say I was working for the county because I was on my third D-dub. So very often the hospital will start the procedures that they use for workers' compensation. Not everything applies. For example, there's nothing that I'm aware of that permits or I don't believe we've ever had a case, Mr. Lindeke, of someone asking for retraining or any of the other kinds of things that go with workers' comp. It is probably the same as any, it's probably better to describe it as being a no-fault based system. We thankfully haven't had any cases in my during my tenure as a working for claims that I believe that the department was so much at fault that if it were in a civil lawsuit, it would have supported a huge award for, I'm sorry, I'm having a senior moment here, a huge award for
pain and suffering. Pain
and suffering is excluded by statute.
Okay.
Punitive damages is what okay. I was thinking of.
Mr. Chair, just one final thought on this. We have had in the past one, I believe, female senator who would never, she always voted against anything where she saw contributory negligence.
Okay.
So that has happened. There have been members who have felt that. But in general, it's always treated like a normal workers' comp situation, where if the person was doing assigned work and injured him or herself, we pay the permanent partial disability.
Thank you. And again, members, I'm not trying to take up more time, but just trying to, as you read through some of these things, you make assumptions that may or may not be accurate or valid when you're trying to make a determination for yourself. So thank you very much, Mr. Hartnett and Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, I have a brief question. Is Mincor Industries, are they a separate entity? I'm
Mr.
just wondering
Chair,
why they wouldn't be.
Yeah, Senator Wieger, they are not a separate entity. They are a unit of the Department of Corrections. I work in legal services for the department. We handle their other legal issues too if they have a contractual dispute. In some cases, we coordinate with the Attorney General's office. In some cases where it doesn't get into the litigation field, we will.
Mr. Chair, I thought Mincor was generated revenue as well, and you know, for very good reasons. I'm just wondering why that wouldn't be a source for reimbursement.
Senator Wieger, Mincor does generate revenue, but that revenue is used for inmate programming. I don't know that. I'm not the person that represents Mincor on everything, so I don't know all the ins and outs of their contractual issue. But in the 16 years I've been doing it, some injury claims are not Mincor claims. For example, there are a number of people that are simply doing jobs in the prison for the prison, and then we have people who are doing jobs in industry. But industry claims have been part of this process as long as I can recall.
Okay.
Anything further on this case? Is there a motion?
I move approval.
Senator Wieger moves approval at the amount stated. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
Mr. Chair, the final injury claim is the claim to Nancy Westcott, who was doing sentencing to service work in Watonwan County. And she stepped in a hole while walking in a ditch and broke bones in her foot. The medical expenses at medical assistance rates here are $8,397.41. And because there was a fracture of what Mr. Hartnett will certainly tell us about, the malleolus, there is a 2% permanent partial disability, which is $1,500, and also a reimbursement of $50.41 in medical expenses that she has already paid. So she already paid the bill. We reimburse her for that. That's probably one exception to the medical assistance rates.
Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke is correct. What made this particular case fairly complicated is that Ms. Westcott had insurance, and under the statute, the subcommittee does not pay for costs which are covered by health insurance. After subsequent review, it appears that she had insurance on just part of these for which there were co-pays or co-insurance. That our recommendation is for payment of both the medical assistance rate where the insurance was not in effect,
and for the coinsurance, which is still owing to the provider where the insurance was in effect. It appears her only out-of-pocket costs here were to the Pomida Pharmacy. Mr. Lindeke, do you want me to talk about the permanency at this point, or...
Mr. Lindeke, yes.
Did you want me to speak to the permanence? In
yes,
this particular
I do.
Case?
Please proceed.
Her injury, and if you'll excuse me, essentially, if you can visualize this as being her shin bone, the shin bone fits down over a portion of the ankle structure like this with tendons, and the malleolus is this little bone here. In this particular case, when she stepped in the hole, she broke that. It ended up being wired together, but the permanency rules provide for an award whenever this is broken, whether or not it's repaired. And that's where the permanency that I recommended comes from. It's from the breaking of this small bone that fits over the ankle structure. Obviously, there are tendons and soft tissue that cushion in there, but that was the basis for it. There would have been a higher permanency if the bone had split and had widened, but the medical evidence was that it was about the same as it would have normally been.
Senator Jungbauer. So Senator Jungbauer is the chair at this point.
Yes. So, Mr. Hartnett, then the total amount that we're seeing here is $83,97.41. Would that be correct? And
The $83,97.41 would be the medical assistance bills.
Okay.
And we figured out for those that were covered by insurance. And then the $15.50.41 was her $1,500 permanency plus the $50.41 for the pain medication.
Okay. Any questions? If not, I guess I will make a motion that we approve this with the $1,550.41 with the permanency and the pain meds, and then the $8,397.41 at the medical assistance rate for the medical bills. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Simon.
I have a procedural request.
Okay.
Try it on for size here. Before we proceed with the property claims.
With you, I want to go back and
yes.
And do the other claims.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could we go back and do the remaining injury claim that happened before you got here, Shah Aziz?
Oh. Yes. And that one's in...
It's the very first one in the pile of DOC injury claims.
Blue tab. That was the one that was added?
He burned himself on the steam pipe in the kitchen at Stillwater.
Mm-hmm.
We've waited 2 years for maximum healing. Mm-hmm. The doctor has examined it, and there is not a large enough scar to have any rateable permanent partial disability.
Right, so that was, Mr. Lindeke, all we were looking at, the medical bills were paid and we were...
There's no medical bills because the person's at the prison.
Okay, so we were looking at a claim for a permanent partial disability, but we have no evidence to rate one.
Move to deny a claim.
Senator Wieger moves to deny the claim. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Claim is denied.
And, Mr. Chair, the other Department of Corrections item is the request for reimbursement, $3,400. There are two letters just before this in your book, I believe. Letters from Nicole Lynn
for
amounts they've already paid. One of them for $2,575.99. The next page for an additional $896.28, total of $3,472.27. And this is a routine annual item that we reimburse them for expenses they've already paid.
So I would move that we would reimburse for the expenses already paid as submitted. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. So Members, yes, I wanted to go back through the ones you started with. I had already made, I guess, my opinion on what I thought was valid based on what the evidence I read through in the folder. So do we want to, Mr. Lindeke, if somebody comes in late,
Mr. Chair, that's right. We need you are the quorum at the time, and now we have enough people to vote on the first two claims, for example, which are against the Department of Revenue. These are people who claim various excuses for not having submitted their or cashed the property tax refund check in one case, or submitted a property tax refund in another.
So I'm just going to tell the members what was my opinion based on reading, and you can give me your thought processes. I was okay with approving the first one, and I didn't believe the second one had reasons to not represent Simon.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly my view as well. I think that I understand that we have statutes, we have limitations in place for a reason. I asked the question, you weren't here, about why do we even have any? Why can't someone cash the check years later? I'm not so persuaded it needs to be 2 years. I know that it is. There's a reasonable cause exception. I think I might come to a different conclusion if this were a case of someone applying for a particular exemption or other kind of tax favor in the law. But this is a refund. This is someone who...
It's
their
money.
It's their money. Yeah. I mean, they're entitled to this.
Yes.
She's has an ongoing disability. She has Parkinson's disease. I found this to be sympathetic, so... I agree with you. And then the second one, the Cron case, this is one where we already have another tribunal that's heard this. The tax court heard testimony and denied this. And I don't think we want to get in the position of being kind of the second bite in the apple when another tribunal has heard it and denied it. So that would be my spot.
And, Mr. Chair, I pointed out that there was one a couple years ago, Ms. Eggy, who we appropriated money to the Department of Revenue to pay her property tax refund, even though she had missed the deadline.
So I think I can go with Simon. The first claim, Renee Johnson, you know, we are a subcommittee sitting in a quasi-judicial capacity governed by principles of equity and justice. And while there are precedents that certainly have some kind of influence over our decisions, the equities and justice of the first case. There seems to be an entitlement to the refund.
Okay. I'm sorry, Representative. I can't see your name tag, and I was Representative Simon and
Wardlow.
I worked together enough. Wardlow. All right. I should know a Wardlow name, right? All right. So
I would concur.
I apologize for that.
As to the Renee Johnson approving and denying Jane Cron.
So could we do those both in one motion?
We could. So I'll make that motion as stated, approving the claim of Renee Johnson for the amount claimed
$1,118,
and that we deny the claim of Jane Crown.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? So Renee Johnson's claim is approved, and Jane Crane's is disapproved.
And Mr. Chair, just to point out Jane Crown's claim, she didn't come back in November, and she didn't call in or come to this meeting today either. The next claims are the claims of the Human Services Department. These are two claims by Hollis Larson, which we discussed at some minor length at Moose Lake facility.
And members, I didn't find any validity to it. And if I was missing something, it seemed that his eyeglasses were paid for.
Move to deny.
All those in favor?
Both claims.
Both claims. All those in favor of denying both claims, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Both claims of Hollis Larson are denied.
Mr. Chair, the other claim was the claim of Stephen Russo, who has been to this subcommittee before. He was on the telephone. We talked with him. He claims he's not mentally ill. He wants $100 million. And the Special Review Board ruled that he should not be released in January of this year.
I found no validity to a $100 million claim, although I would like some of that money myself. But
Mr. Chair, and again, I just have to say, I mean, apart from the underlying merits, there are other avenues Yes. More than one. I mean, he's had a lawsuit in federal court. There's an internal avenue as well in terms of the department, so we're not in the business of providing extra avenues.
Rule one would apply that he can be in a different forum he should be. Plus, we're certainly not well-equipped to determine whether somebody is crazy.
Right.
I'm not certain whether we can even hear it, but since it's a force. But
yes,
but
whether or not it would be in our jurisdiction in reality, yes. So I would actually move to deny the Stephen Russo claim.
And we notified Mr. Russo that if the claim is denied today, he cannot refile it unless there's some tremendous new evidence that he finds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McGee. All those in favor of denying the claim of Stephen Russo?
Aye.
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 Those opposed? Claim is denied. I had another one in my book here.
There's Guy Israel Green.
Yes, Guy Israel Green.
Wanting to be paid at $50 a day for wrongful incarceration.
Mr. Chair? I know you weren't here, but I think Mr. Lindeke did a good job of describing how this is distinguishable from a case recently as last year, the Hines case, where there was a $50 a day compensation. There, it was basically an error of the court in sentencing. This isn't that case.
Okay.
This is a case where, you know, as often or sometimes happens, he won on appeal, and he got basically wants that time back. I would too, but I don't think this is the place for that. So I would move that we deny the claim.
Okay. We didn't have any other basis.
All right.
The motion is made to deny the request of Guy Israel Green. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, request denied.
And finally, Mr. Chair, we have the pothole claim.
Yes.
Lori Brosco of St. Paul. And you've probably read that.
Yes. And I don't know what I was, in favor of it here, and I know in some counties and municipalities where I've dealt with, depending on the circumstances, we do in fact reimburse. I seem to, in my own opinion, found that kind of evidence here, but I didn't know in terms of claims against the state how that fit.
And Mr. Chair, I pointed out two instances, one in 1996 and another in 2001, where even though the department said they should not be paid because we fixed it as soon as we could,
yes,
as soon as we knew about it,
mm-hmm,
where the claims subcommittee, in the case of a pothole on Interstate 35W or E, I can't remember which, we appropriated $500 to fix the guy's Oldsmobile. And in another case, a woman up in Duluth where someone before her had knocked some road dividers into her path, and they moved them back out of the way as soon as they found out. But in both of those cases, the excuse of the department that we do things as quickly as we can when we find out, in those instances, the subcommittee paid. So it has happened. Not often, but it has happened.
What I wanted to comment on is what I wanted to be careful of and I made notes of is precedent setting. So I don't want to set a precedent that, especially with roads like there are this year and everybody out there knows what they're like, I don't want to start having everybody think that they can come to us. So I was looking for some guidance on whether or not this particular item would set a precedent. So Representative Wardle?
Yes, I don't think actually we have the ability to hear this claim or jurisdiction over it because as the department's one of the department's memoranda indicates the claimant's relief could be sought in district court or conciliation court. I don't believe that avenue was taken. So given that there could be jurisdiction in another setting, we shouldn't hear the claim. We should deny the claim.
Okay. Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair, it's fitting that this is the last one because for me, I mean in this category, because for me this was the one I agonized over the most. I mean, we all as drivers sympathize with her. I do worry about the precedent. I ask questions for a reason about what the internal procedure is right now. Do they publicize it? Do people really know that they can go to the department? And they have acknowledged 10 claims out of many, many more that they've gotten in. I'm just really reluctant here to make this the pothole committee.
Yeah.
And I tried to, so I'm gonna vote to deny the claim very reluctantly, because but I don't feel quite as bad because there are other avenues here to Ms. Brostrom. This is a tough one. I mean, I know, too, I mean, in fairness to her, the department, it sounds like they grant or deny these claims based on a negligence standard, but it's negligence as to whether they came when it was reported, not negligence. They don't hold themselves to a negligence standard whether appearance of the pothole in and of itself was negligence. That's off the radar. So anyone who says, hey, department, you owe me money, you should have known based on the ruts, and I think Representative Wardlaw asked some excellent questions about the ruts and all the rest, but so that's not the negligence that they're willing to concede to. They will only concede to negligence in the case of slowness to fix it, not in cases of possible negligence for appearing in the first place. So that's why I think it's very interesting on both sides. I'm reluctantly going to vote no.
Yeah. Senator Wigert, do you have any input for me on that one?
I reluctantly would vote yes to approve it. I actually do remember when Senator Kelly in 96 or 7 presented that claim on a pothole. We did hear from Ms. Brostrom, is that her name? And I thought that there was a notice provided. I think there's constructive notice, whether the public or if the staff through the department lets people aware of it. And yes, it was a Jaguar, but you know, I think it should be approved.
Mm-hmm. And just for the committee's, my background thoughts, 8 years on transportation, and that is one of our main mandates in our Constitution. So I struggle a lot, especially in the metro area, when we have a lot of programs that we're not commanded to fund, and we don't tend to take our roads as serious as I think we should. So, I mean, I'm really struggling here because I don't want to set a precedent. I want to be very clear, and if there's other avenues. But reading through that one a couple times, even as small as it was, I just struggle with sending a message to MnDOT as well as our local counties. In Anoka, we're getting a lot of property damage from roads in Anoka County, and after several cars careened off the road on a major road in Anoka County, the best they can do is block off the road and make us have a detour. So what I'm saying is I don't want to set a precedent here, but maybe my first blush I was going to vote yes just to send a message. But as I think more and more about it, having been a mayor before and trying to not set a precedent, I'm leaning towards saying deny, again, because there's other avenues.
Yes,
and it's not our...
I could add, I concur with Representative Simon's comments. It appears to me that if we were a district court, we were all one judge in a district court, there might be a claim here for negligence with regard to failure to prevent the appearance of potholes. But we are not a district court. We're not a conciliation court.
No.
And our subcommittee rules four E. The subcommittee shall not consider claims with respect to which a proceeding may be maintained by or on behalf of the claimant against the state in the courts of the state. I think that does apply here.
And that does it. And you get down to issues when it's small enough is I sometimes think our own folks don't go out and do things because at local levels they have vicarious immunity on certain issues. You know, they know that, you know, people have redress through whether it's conciliation court, going to district court, and yet counties know, cities know, the state knows, nobody's going to file in a court for $200 some. It's just way more time and effort than to get that back. So I really struggle with how do you fix the problem without sending a message, and yet I agree with you guys, and so I'm just stating all this. You know, I don't want to be the pothole committee, and I don't want to set a precedent. But my first blush was to say yes, because I really want to send a strong message. Well, this is part of our job as the government.
Mr. Chair, as a legislator, the wheels were turning as we heard the testimony. I mean, honestly, I mean this is fodder for a possible bill. So,
redress the issue.
As Minnesotans, we all drive on potholes, and this is something that maybe some of us can collaborate on, maybe some
great
system.
So I'll let somebody else make the motion on that one, and we'll deal with it, whatever.
I move, Mr. Chair, that we deny the claim.
The motion is made to deny the claim of Lori Brostrom. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion is, the claim is denied.
Mr. Chair,
technically, in order to approve or to take any action, you need two members of the Senate to vote and for it and two members of the House.
Oh, so we...
So we actually have not, I believe, according to our rules, made
Mr.
a decision.
Lincoln.
Yes.
Per our rules of procedure, when the rules of procedure state that we shall not consider claims,
yes,
that can be heard in other places like district court, conciliation court. Does that mean the claim is not properly before us?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow, I don't believe that that's the case, because these are rules of the subcommittee. These aren't laws, and they're not legislative rules. And many times over the years, the subcommittee violates its own rule as long as two people on both sides vote in favor of a claim or vote in favor of ignoring that rule or any other rule.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it, Mr. Lindeke. So,
actually, Mr. Chair, then on the previous motion, then we'll need yes vote from Senator...
Senator Newman.
Senator Newman. So.
And I think he's in judiciary right
yes,
now.
Yes, he is. So we could try to go find him to
could
deal with that.
Could go try to find him, and we could, in the meantime, deal with the property claims from
yes.
the Department
yeah.
of
I see if you can find him.
I do need to leave by 1:30.
Okay, so let's expedite that. Where did I put my other?
That's gone. He is, I believe, gone. Yeah, we don't need him. But we do need you on this one. Oh, and Mr. Chair, there's one other issue that Ms. Ducher pointed out to me, mm-hmm. and I think it's an awkward issue, but I don't know why this subcommittee would do it. But we need to, from she tells me, have approval of the minutes of the prior meeting. Well, of course, that was in November with six totally different members of the subcommittee. I'm not sure. I don't know what to think of that.
Totally different.
I think we ought to do it.
All right. I believe Mr. Simon wants to move that the minutes of the prior meeting be approved.
So moved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Well, on that,
post done. The minutes are approved at the last subcommittee.
Now, the property claims... I had one that troubled me, uh-huh. and it's Calvin King.
Right.
And the others, despite the fact that I understand that probably in some cases the department may be responsible for some of these things that have happened to some of these people, there just isn't significant enough proof that we can pass these claims. But and I want to point out to people again that the department pays claims that they acknowledge they're responsible for. We only get the ones they deny. But in Calvin King's case, I was troubled by the fact that his wedding band seemed to be on his finger when he left one prison and wasn't there when he got to the other. And we got an email, a lengthy discussion of this from Ms. Lind. I tried to hand copies of it out to everybody. I don't
yeah,
know.
That one.
Or take that one. Yeah, that's a good one right there. And so you could read that if you take a few minutes. This, unless you want to first deal with all the other claims and then get to Mr. King.
Can I do it in the back?
You could do that in one
yes.
motion.
Okay. I'll move that. Having reviewed the material submitted with regard to all the property claims, apart from that of Mr. Calvin King, I would deny all said claims.
So it's a motion to deny all the claims except Mr. King.
Procedure, but should we just... I think you might have said it wrong. We should pull Mr. King's out and move to deny it. I don't know if you said it quite that way, but all right. We got it all there. So the motion is to deny all property claims and pull out Calvin King's for consideration at this point. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. Motion carries. All claims, property claims, are denied. We have before us, other than Calvin King's, that we have before us, and we'll take a few minutes to read through the latest information.
May I say something, please? Hi, I'm Nicole Lind. I work for the Department of Corrections. And before you take your time and go through this Calvin King claim, mm-hmm. I would just like to tell you that Mr. King is not married.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Mm. Thank you.
Has he ever been married?
Mr. Chair, I looked at that this morning. Our records indicate that he does not list any wife or former wife, and the girlfriend he does have listed was also the victim of his committing offense. He may have previously been married, but he, at least our position is from the evidence, he did not come into the prison system with the wedding.
Mr. Chair, the point is, however, at some point he had a ring, and at some point he didn't have it. So we just won't call it a wedding ring anymore.
All right. And Mr. Hartnett and members, it's actually getting pretty customary out in society today to wear multiple rings, and some of them may mimic a wedding ring. So you'll see that as being pretty common. So I guess if we don't refer to it as a wedding band, we'll look at it on the face of however it might be described.
Mr. Chair, Senator John Boer, I simply looked at that because Mr. King referred
to it as a wedding ring. Okay, thank you. This is interesting already.
Mr. Chair, as far as the other items, the eyeglasses and the Bible, mm-hmm. the evidence is that there were, even before this email today, I believe that he had books and he had a Bible, and he had glasses. We just don't know exactly which glasses or whether it was the same Bible. But it shouldn't, I don't know, that shouldn't take up, that part of it shouldn't take up too much of our time. I'm just curious about the ring and why, if someone saw it and it wasn't allowed, they didn't take it away from him, and why it hasn't shown up.
Perhaps, Ms. Lynn, you could, it just appears on this that there seems to be some discrepancy as to whether or not, I mean, if you look at the paragraph 2, at time of transfer from Lino to FRB on 12-7-2010, Lino paperwork indicated that King possessed a wedding band. Is it Department of Corrections stating that something was filled out wrong in a form?
I'm actually going to refer this one to Ray.
Okay.
Senator Jungbauer, it appears when Mr. King came into the system, he didn't have a ring. Okay. A little bit by way of background, one of the things that we try to do is to limit the property that can be used as contraband. A ring, because they're made of gold, is something that can easily be used in part of the underground economy. So offenders are not allowed to have any sort of metallic jewelry except wedding bands. And that's why you would have that kind of an odd situation that says if you don't come in with one, you can't have one later on, because that's an exception. Okay. When Mr. King came in, he apparently did not have a wedding band. We have to assume that because his initial property inventory, he didn't list a wedding band. He was transferred from, I don't know, I think it was probably, if this was SOP, he was probably transferred from St. Cloud, which is a reception facility, to MCF Lino Lakes. Now, whenever anybody transfers, they do an inventory of their property. The inventory, as he was leaving Lino Lakes, said he, in fact, had a ring.
I'm guessing it was on his hand. Okay. He shows up at the Faribault facility, and because jewelry like watches and wedding bands are worn, the Faribault people ask, do you have any jewelry? And we have to assume that at that point his answer was no, because they didn't list it. It's their procedure to ask the offender, who may be very well wearing their watch, wearing their wedding band, do you have this? Show it to us. Guy didn't say anything, so we don't know what he said because they don't record an answer, but they simply didn't record the fact that he had a ring. Okay. So there are two possible scenarios. One is that there was a ring that was in his property that was in the transport vehicle, and that it somehow got lost between the time he left Lionel Lakes and when he arrived at MCF Faribault. Okay. This wasn't a seg pack up, so it wasn't a matter of his property being packed up and stored. The other possibility is that that ring may well have been in his pocket, and if he in fact had it, because he knew that it was contraband. Now, why it got missed at Lionel Lakes, I don't know. A corrections officer wouldn't have any reason to question the fact that somebody was wearing a wedding band, because they wouldn't know the history. Now, as Ms. Lynn said, our records indicate that Mr. King wasn't married. He may have had a wedding band from a previous marriage. We don't know. But what's more telling to me is the fact that he didn't have one recorded when he came in. And we're careful with that because a piece of gold that's worth $100 is a high-value thing in an underground economy.
Mr. Lynn. So it appears to me that what we have here is evidence in the form of the property inventory records that Mr. King had a gold ring at one point.
Yes.
And did not then when he was transferred.
Correct.
Taken in, right? And then we have Mr. King's testimony, or written statement, that he had a ring in it. And it was lost or otherwise taken from him, correct?
Correct.
And we don't have any other evidence with regard to how the ring disappeared or confiscation of the ring.
As is often the case, Representative Wardlow, we don't have any evidence of what happens in between the time that those property inventories are taken.
So it appears to me that the only evidence we have is that statement of Mr. King.
Correct.
And then the property inventory, which shows that his ring was lost.
Right.
So based on that, I don't know that we can do anything but conclude that Mr. King is telling the truth without making a credibility determination, which we don't have evidence to make.
So, Representative Wardlow, did you have a motion you want to make based on that?
Yeah, I would move that we approve the claim in the amount of $375.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wardlow, the ring represents $100 of that amount. The other two amounts were the Bible and and a pair of glasses. We do have evidence that a corrections officer found those two items in his living room unit.
Staff observed the Bible
listed here, Mike. To award $100.
$100.
$100.
He had one, and now he doesn't have it.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative.
I just wanted to say, I think, well put by Representative Wardlow. Normally we don't have these issues with the property claims. That's why we summarily dismissed all the rest of them. I think this is a special case, and I appreciate the fact that $100 and a gold ring is a big deal in the underground economy, but based on the facts on the record here, I agree with Representative Wardlow. So, without making any value judgment as to whether this is a good person or not, or entirely honest person or not, all the time, I'm going to vote for the motion.
Mr. Chair.
So, we're just to clarify, then we would be $100 because it's just the ring. Because according to this documentation, the glasses and the Bible showed back up later.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out to the members of the subcommittee
that in the past, when we have had property claims from prisoners that we feel sympathetic to, rather than actually putting them in the claims bill, mm-hmm. we have instead asked the department to go ahead and pay the claim. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's hopefully what will happen in this case. I wouldn't want to put Mr. King and his $100 ring in the claims bill if we can avoid it.
And that makes sense.
I totally agree.
Yes,
we should.
Yes, we cut $5 billion.
Representative, my motion to the fact
to modify it to $100 and to ask the department to pay that. And you know, on the face of it, again, we can't make value judgments. But looking through the paperwork and even things that say one book was there and then two books were there and somebody checked off a ring, and if they inadvertently and allowed for a prisoner to make a claim based on somebody inadvertently checking a box, we only have before us what we have before us. So it's hard for us to make that kind of a value judgment. So I appreciate the succinctness and the way you put it, Representative Wardlow. So we have before us a motion to direct. Then do we say to direct Department of Corrections to pay?
Mr. Chair, let's ask whether if well, we direct them to, they will pay this claim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, if you directed us to or asked us to, we would comply in either event.
Thank
so
you.
We could just ask them to without a motion and.
I think we need a motion.
We need a motion.
Okay, we'll have a motion. Representative Wardlow moves that the department that we ask the Department of Corrections to pay the $100 for the lost wedding as reported. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure there's Bibles available too.
Well, he supposed to back in Bible the letter, the Bible and the glasses back. Showed back up, so.
We don't know if it's the same Bible, but he's got a Bible.
Yes,
he referred to it.
I appreciate the good explanation. You know, somebody maybe just checked the wrong box. And
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Did we hear back at all about whether anybody can find Senator Newman?
So we could.
Oh, that's right.
Well, the claim would still be denied, so it's just a matter of having another vote.
So are you going to join the no's? I mean, the yes, whatever.
The no's.
Do you change your vote so that we can go out of here?
Yes, I'll
okay, let's.
He's not on his way here, the senator.
He's still in Judiciary Committee, and I don't know what his LA told me that he would come as soon as he can. I guess there are some pretty big issues that they're facing today, and he's been testifying, and I don't know, things like that, and so she's like.
Okay, somebody on the prevailing side wants to move to reconsider, and then
I will move to reconsider the motion whereby we were voting on a. Let me find the name.
Rostrom.
All those in favor of reconsidering the motion? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. We have before us the motion to deny the claim for the damage to the car. All those in favor of denying the claim signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Okay, the motion carries. We have the proper number of votes. Seeing no more business before us, we are adjourned.
Mr. Chair, can we just leave the materials?
You certainly can.
I'm happy to be alive and be in front of people. So
thank you.
Thank you for coming. I was reading all that stuff.
Yes.
Was it fun?